This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the...
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the...
The Place to Be.
Yes, the Place to Be. The Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Ugh. Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling. So.
That's what she said!
So why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Aural. A-U-R-A-L.
What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Vincent's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course, is the lacrosse player. Bismarck. No, was it Bismarck? Was that his
name? Bismarck.
Bismarck. No, who's the other guy I'm getting confused with?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big buzz play, and that is in my extra queen size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the fix.
I think they might, shock wall.
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're
our
favorite. Opener.
To do worse than Josh Richard. Tell me what I already know. No. Can you feel the heat? Yeah. Say hello. Go. Yeah. Viva la raza.
Wanna be Latino? If you're not cheating, you're not trying. I lie, I cheat, I steal. Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to the great episode of the one and only podcast. I'm your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Wednesday evening. A little flippity flop, a little good for the goose, is good for the gander here for us, Scotty, because we are flipping nights. No pun intended, but we are flipping evenings for our accord. And we're here on a Wednesday. How are you doing?
We are. Good evening, JR. Kind of kicking it old school. We used to record the old, headlines on. On Wednesdays, sometimes back in the old days,
like the old, yeah, it did feel like the old days. I was nervously waiting the message from when your meeting was going to wrap up.
That's right.
Sprint downstairs. So
that's right. You had a rough day anyway, which we'll get into in a minute. But yeah. Pleasure as always, JR. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Place to Be Nation, to episode 394 of the Mothership. We are into February, and I'm telling you, you and I had an interesting conversation yesterday. We were talking about Punxsutawney Phil. Who's an old fucking groundhog? What is he, like 300 years old?
Yeah.
They don't even put numbers on him anymore like they do. Like our man Chad Campbell would appreciate this because Ugga, who's the mascot for the Georgia Bulldogs, anytime one of them dies, they just add a number like Ugga 6, Ugga 7. But it's been Punxsutawney Phil since like 1880-something.
Yeah.
And
I wonder if they're all related or do they just get like a random groundhog? Or does they probably be sired from the previous one?
Sired. Sired groundhog.
Does it have to be of his loins?
Anyway, we were talking because obviously Groundhog Day was earlier in the week, and usually it's like he sees a shadow, which means mm-hmm. spring. Like once every, we were talking about it. It
no,
seems like once every like 19 years.
If he sees a shadow, it's winter.
I mean, doesn't see a shadow. He probably doesn't see his shadow like every 19 years or something. It feels like it's always 6 weeks of winter. And the first he didn't see his shadow Tuesday earlier in the week, so spring should be around the corner.
It was like only the 18th time since like 1897 or something.
Yeah, 1887. Yeah. And now they haven't all been documented, but of the documented years mm-hmm. since 1887 that they have about him, you know, looking up, popping up out of the hole, only 18 times has he predicted early spring.
Right.
The other 109 million, we get, 3 feet of snow. But meanwhile, it's like 55 out right now. I don't know if it's raining up in your neck of the woods. It's pouring here.
Yeah, it's been pouring. And thankfully, it's 55 because this would have been a lot of snow to be
yes.
shoveling.
It was like last year when, remember last year we had a couple of blizzards, but we didn't get a lot of snow in late January through the end of the winter. But don't forget, it was like 11 degrees every day. So even with sun, the snow like never left.
Yeah.
And
no,
of course.
It's been really nice out. Yeah, it was warm today. It was really warm. Monday was like 65 here. So
yeah. It wasn't that warm here. It was like 55, 56, but still pretty solid, though. It seems a far cry from the mm-hmm. from the snow you and I shoveled two Sunday mornings
ago. I
wish
we didn't bother now. Just would have melted.
No, yeah, really. At least you have a, your two Jeeps take up a lot of space in the driveway. So, did you have a good weekend? I haven't, feel like I haven't talked to you.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know.
Oh, it was Grandmama's birthday, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, 90th birthday. Yep,
that's so. Right.
We had two pregnancy announcements that neither of them knew the other was pregnant, and they're due like 3 days apart. So there's a lot of excitement going down.
Rosero rabbits.
Today was rough, though. I over the last few days, I've got like a grinding noise in my car, so I knew it was something bad. So I went, dropped it off today, and needed new brakes, new rotors, new calipers, new pads.
That
and then
sucks.
They did some other stuff, and I just had them do the inspection because it's due in a couple months. So that was a nice $850 bill.
Ugh, brakes
dropped on my lap. Yeah, dropped on my lap. So
pads aren't bad. I mean, if you can catch them early enough, but once you hit the grind and then the rotors, you're done because rotors are.
Well, they said too. My calipers were like, you know, my caliper Winfields were very. I guess they were.
They were whining. Oh no, sorry.
They were all jacked up.
They're all jacked up.
They were jacked up. They were like they had slipped out of their spot. I don't know. I got the whole write up, but it was not good under there. It was a lot of negative stuff going.
Oh, it's good you got to take. I'm glad you weren't on like the highway or something and your brakes went out at least. You were probably on city roads, so good, good.
Yeah. So that was tough. And then I got home, and yes, my son, we're sitting in a chair. He's almost one, and he's kind of, you know, we're playing around, and he does this claw, but his thumb goes up my nose and like gashed the inside wall, and it took me a minute to realize how bad it hurt. But once I did, I like started flipping out. I like yanked his hand out. It fucking hurt. But then all of a sudden, I pull his thumb out. And my nose just starts, like, blood starts, you know, coming out. And then I'm, like, start to choke, and I'm fucking spinning up. Blood is going down my throat. It's coming out my nose. It hurt like a bitch. I was like, what the fuck? Went full heel on me.
The Coventry death grip.
Jesus.
He manged you.
I was like, what the hell?
Jesus.
You know, I'd rather get, like, punched in the face than what he did to me. Like, that hurt. It
was
really
his Trump
hurt.
Hair flopping. He was probably all.
Oh, my God. Crazy son of a bitch he is.
Wow. Look at that, huh?
Yeah. Kind of fit right in on this show we're going to talk about here tonight.
Yes, exactly.
Because he showed me No Mercy.
Yes, he did.
Hey, what is going on here?
We're good, Sunshine. Watch the Super Bowl. Been a long week for some of us who are in the industry. Every 3 years, of course, the networks rotate. Let me ask you, JR, before we continue. We've watched plenty of Super Bowls. Yeah. Which network do you think does the best coverage? Do you like CBS? Do you like Fox? Do you like NBC?
I don't know.
Who you think does the best? You I mean, I know you normally watch CBS because the Jets are on CBS mostly.
Yeah. Who
does
has
matter
it
matter to
year?
You?
Fox or no, NBC?
No, CBS is doing it.
Oh, whatever. They're not letting what's the fuck stupid face do it, are they?
Nance? Of course, it'll be Nance and Phil.
No, Nance is okay. Yeah. See,
no, it'll be Nance and Phil.
A lot of people hate Phil. I don't mind him as much as others. Like I just whatever. Like I know he sounds stupid a lot of the time. Deardorff, when I like Ian Eagle, but Deardorff is awful.
No, no, they will not have Dan Deardorff. No,
he is brutal.
It would either be it's Phil and it's Nance and Phil, Joe and Troy, and then Al Michaels and Collinsworth.
Yeah, I'm not a big Buck guy, but if there's one spot he's more tolerable, it's football. I think he's better in football than he is with baseball. Baseball, I find him much more intolerable.
Well, it's funny you say that because the doctor, he always says it's as much as he hates him as much as you do. And he's like, but he's like he calls it as a Yankee fan. He's the voice of the dynasty.
Yeah.
You know, he's still stupid.
But the NBC, I think I like the announcers the best on NBC because I like Al Michaels a lot. So I guess I prefer NBC the most. But I don't really care. I mean,
did they do last year's game? I think they did last year's game. Yeah.
To me, I kind of almost zone out on the commentary a lot of times during the Super Bowl because there's so much going on. And this year, we're actually going to Boneheads. They're having a buffet. All you can eat.
Oh, nice.
So
that's right.
Paid up front. We're going to that. So I think even less I'll hear, you know, pay attention to the presentation as much as the food, the atmosphere, the game, commercials.
What was the deal? Wasn't it like, it was pretty good, right?
It was 40? $25 and then.
Oh, 25. That's right. I figured. That's right.
They're doing appetizers for an hour and then like sandwiches and wings. And then soft drinks are included too.
Nice. So a chicken nacho platter.
Well, we'll see.
You'll be shooing people away. Sorry, I just sneezed on it.
True. Yeah, I'm curious what they do for the appetizers. I do know that they're not going to. You can't order any. Like you can only eat what they provide.
So. Right. Right. Oh, speaking of, I know we're continuing, but you know, Boneheads is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
How are those those potato skin wings that you tried the other day.
Yeah, they were tasty. They're very good.
Yeah.
Although I was a little pissed off because we got the my wife and I got those and we split a burger,
mm-hmm.
and I really got hosed on the fries, which is unlike them. Like they couldn't have been more than like 12 French fries in the box.
Oh, that's weird for them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I let Matt have it, and he forwarded the message on. So as much as whenever I get chance to bust Matt up, I get to,
you got a takeout.
We do. Okay. Kids went to bed, and we ordered takeout. So.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I wasn't very pleased, you know, especially when you're splitting them. So I only got like six fries. So it was disappointing.
Very rare. Yeah. It's been an off night. Was it during the week? Oh, no. What was it?
It was Tuesday.
The night, right?
Yeah,
Tuesday.
I just said it was yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, you mean yesterday? Yeah. So that's weird. Maybe it was
yesterday during the week.
I guess so. Maybe not in some other people's worlds.
Sure.
All right. Okay. Tonight, inside the Big Steel Box, we're trying to stay, as you can tell, we're trying to stay very lighthearted because this is not a very lighthearted show. It's going to be very sad when we get to the end. Tonight, of course, inside the Big Steel Box, known as the Vintage Vault, we bring you No Mercy 2005. Like Big Al gave you No Mercy today. And we all know this is a very sad show, and we'll get to that stuff at the end. Because actually, another secondary show where, I mean, I won't say it was the greatest show on earth, but there were some surprises. I was, a couple matches I was pleasantly surprised that I thought that were better than I remember them being. And of course, the sadness at the end. All right. October 9th, 2005. Live from the brand spanking new Toyota Center in Houston, Texas. Of course, Houston, not new. We've been to plenty of Houston pay-per-views, but this is a new building.
Mm-hmm.
So give us the background, JR, on the Toyota Center.
Opened October 6th, 2003. So it took them a couple of years to make it here.
Mm-hmm.
Construction cost, $235 million. Architect was Populous. The tenants, of course, the Houston Rockets, that still play there till this day. The Houston Arrows of the AHL played there for 10 years. And the Comets of the WNBA played there for 3 years. So. There you go.
Yep.
Toyota.
Last time we were in the city, we were in the old building.
Mm-hmm.
Bad Blood 2003 was at the old Compaq Center. By the way, you know, interesting. I didn't notice that till I looked it up today. The Compaq Center, the old Summit, is now like a church.
It's like one of those mega churches.
Yeah, like one of those mega churches, which I kind of cool. I never knew that.
So a little trivia. We'll see if you can guess. October 6th, 2003 was the first concert. Any guess who it was? I'll give you a look. I mean, obviously, you need a hint or two, but it's a band.
Okay.
And it's more closer to your era than mine. And it's not just a cheap shot how old you are.
I'll say Aerosmith?
No, Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, okay. They were touring in 2003. I don't know.
So, and the first Rockets game came on October 30th. Just want to take a random guess who they played.
October 30, 2005, beginning of the year, usually it's
2003.
Usually it's a conference foe. I'll say the Lakers.
No, the Denver Nuggets.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So, there you go.
But yeah, this is the old Summit, the old Compaq Center, now a big church, the Brentwood Baptist something or other. Big church. So the Summit is still standing to this day. It's just not called that anymore.
They should have done that with the Silverdome and had Jordan Duncan run his sermon.
Dunking people in the big pool in the middle. Your attendance, 7,000, obviously curtailed due to the stage. Your buy rate, 0.55, not really that great. And your announcers at ringside, of course, Michael Cole and Taz, who Michael Cole, and I'll tell you, JR, and I'm going to mention it. I'm going to talk about it when we get into some of the matches. Not on his game tonight, in my opinion. Taz was great. Taz had some good lines. Michael was a little off, and I'll get into a few of his flubs. But, he was still pretty good.
And
but
I do want to call it, too. So 7,000 attendance for concerts holds 19,000, basketball 1855. So, half.
I mean, and the stage doesn't take up that much seats.
No,
you probably lose maybe 3,000 seats, 4,000. Yeah. So not a good crowd for an early, for a secondary pay-per-view. Of course, our usual state and arena fun facts. This is Texas's 10th pay-per-view.
Oh, there you go.
I thought it'd be more for this point. And it's Houston's first, as I mentioned, since Bad Blood 2003. So
kind of makes sense that it wouldn't be more, though, in some ways, because it's really just Houston and Dallas. I mean, San Antonio had Tuesday night in Texas, but they don't really go there for paper. Oh, I guess they had a Rumble 97, too. But
yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they've only had two. So in Houston, no, they don't go to Houston too often.
Actually, they've been to San Antonio twice. They were there for Rumble 97. I think they were there for
Tuesday in Texas. That's what I just said.
Tuesday in Texas. No, there was another one. I think Survivor Series 94 was there.
Yes, you're right.
Freeman Coliseum.
So
yeah,
three there.
So they were in San Antonio early, and then they stopped, and now they pretty much just rotate between Houston and Dallas.
Right.
So
because they weren't even in Dallas for a long time.
No, they weren't. We just did our homecoming. They go into Dallas a lot later on in the decade.
Right.
Time now for our Sutton report.
No, is that already?
Yes, it is.
All right. So, No Mercy. Do you remember the theme song?
No clue.
Save Me by Shinedown.
Shinedown. You get a lot. There'll be a lot of Shinedown over the next like 4-5 years. Like a boatload of songs.
Do you remember the sponsor?
Skittles.
No, PlayStation 2.
Oh. Okay.
So I'm not good with the PlayStation timeline. Like, if you told me PlayStation 2 was still the main system in 05,
I know, yeah,
I believe it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I still had my PS2 was cranking in 2005. I didn't get my 360 till like 2009, 2010. So my PS2 cranked pretty good.
All right,
yeah, weird.
Here's your roll call. Batista is your champion still. Chris Benoit still your U.S. champion. Animal and Hyde and Reich is your tag team champions. And Nunzio still your cruiserweight champion. We saw a release on October 29th. Brian Hebner was released, so I think this finishes off the Hebners for good. After,
yes, yeah, they're gone,
sealing their bootleg merch out in the cars. So Hebners are all gone. October 31st was another release, and I guess we'll mention it here, but we'll see him again at our next show.
Mm-hmm.
Christian actually gets released, and we'll talk about him on this show. He wrestles, but
yes.
So 1,018 matches in the promotion, TV record 185, 233, and 17. Best win and loss record came in 2000. He had 51 wins and 54 losses. Of course, most of those in tag matches.
Yes, and they were champions for a good stretch. So
October 22nd, Crusher Lisowski died. It's at age 79, former AWA and WWE competitor.
Nobody we know, or nobody I remember anyway. Well,
sure?
Retired.
You didn't go see him,
Chris Early? No, Vladislav Savisko, maybe, but Crusher Lisowski. Stanislawsy? No, there's a couple of Zabiscos. Anyway, no, I didn't remember him.
Anyway.
Only one death.
That's it.
Because the other death is the following month.
So. SmackDown, 321 episodes. Velocity, 171. Impact, 66. Mm-hmm. On October 6th, it was announced WrestleMania 22 tickets would go on sale in 9 days. On October 11th, it was announced that WWE 24/7 would hit 6 more cable systems. Of course, would eventually be in 22 states and Canada at that point once those could hit. Are you surprised 24/7 didn't make it to the United Kingdom, Scott?
Very surprised. Yeah. It was probably the second biggest market in the world besides us. I mean, you would think of all people that would, and you know, look how long it took the network to go over there. So it is really weird that it never got over there. I don't know if Sky it had to probably been Sky Sports, and they probably were being ball breakers about, you know, payments,
right,
or whatever. That had to have been what it was, because you figure Sky Sports, I mean, they would have jumped all over it.
I don't know how the on-demand technology works over there either.
Yeah, probably. It might have been maybe it was a little bit of a struggle. But.
On October 15th, it was announced that WrestleMania 22 sold out in 2 minutes. So there you go. On October 17th, 24/7 would be available in Japan. And on 10/28, it was announced that WrestleMania, the complete anthology, and they did talk about this on these pay-per-views, would be released on DVD. 21 discs. The fan would see over 200 matches from WrestleMania to WrestleMania 21. So that was a big deal at the time.
Yes.
Releasing the full DVD box set. That was the first one really to go, right?
Yeah.
They'd eventually do like SummerSlam and the other ones. But
yeah, SummerSlam come in the cooler. They would do that in a couple years.
Yeah.
Survivor Series, they never finished. And I don't know how far they went with the Rumble. The only annoying part of that box, I never got it, but I know a couple guys that did. And the annoying part was they had five, you know, what do they call them, digipacks. One through 5, 6 through 10, 11 through 15, and 21 was on the top of the cover. Like, if you lifted cover of the box,
it
was stuck at the top, which
and
I thought
was
a little
And they were
precarious.
All pretty heavily edited as well, like the music and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. They honestly weren't that great. It was a bummer.
Right. So. The best set was the old VHS, the 1 through 15, because that had that was like the pay-per-view versions completely intact.
Yes.
Like, I don't think they cut anything out of those. So
no, those are awesome, those tapes. I still have mine. Yeah.
Bound for Glory, October 23rd from Universal Studio. Rhino captured the championship over Jeff Jarrett with Tito Ortiz as the special referee. Jarrett and Kevin Nash were supposed to originally fight, and Nash had a mild cardiac episode the day of the show. Not the first time that happened to him. Right, Jeff Jarrett had won the NWA title from Raven. I remember this big deal because Raven had finally defeated him over the summer, and then he won it back. Well, maybe it was even in the fall, and he won it back from him fairly quickly at a BCW event held in Canada, or it was either Canada or Michigan. It was Canada.
I do remember this. Yeah, it was Canada.
America's Most Wanted had interfered, so
yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Canada.
Rhino had gotten the shot by winning a gauntlet, so he was able to get the match there. So anyway, case notes of honor he shares with us: Kobashi versus Joe on October 1st, Unforgettable at October 2nd. Percy Pringle III announced that Jim Cornette would be the new authority figure, and James Gibson made his final appearance. Mm-hmm. October 14th, the Monster Abyss returned for the first time since January of 04, joined the Embassy. That's pretty much it. Curry Man returned on October 29th. So, and also we'll just cover the Heat matches here. We had William Regal and Paul Burchill, who we'll talk about eventually, defeat Paul London and Brian Kendrick.
Yes. Yep. And you'll see more of them, London and Kendrick. Actually, you'll see more of all of them further down the line.
So. What do you think why Paul London never was from London?
I don't know. That seemed very Federation era-ish. Like if Paul London... I forgot about the before the first starts. I totally forgot about that.
I keep forgetting CSI and lip sync battle.
I totally forgot that we actually still had a couple more. It's not the same.
So
we begin JR.
It's
our first
match.
Not
the full orgy, but you get half a orgy.
50% discount.
Not the same.
It's like chat. You don't really get the herb eight. Right. So the our first match, six-person intergender match. Mm-hmm. Three title matches in the show. Mm-hmm. But the tag straps not on the line. Your tag team champions are in this six-man tag.
Yep.
Tell us about it.
You had the strap as you were hiding in the shadows. This is Christy Hemme's final pay-per-view match, Scott. In late November, she was sent down to OVW to stay fresh while the creative team worked on ideas for her. Unfortunately, the office claimed they had no ideas, and that due to budget cuts, she was dumped on December 5th. After being released, Christy kind of hinted that she left on her own because she was staying true to her morals. On at Lockdown 06, she would move to TNA, competed on the active roster, and eventually moved into a role of backstage interviewer, and then eventually into in-ring announcer, and she's still there till this day. So good for her. Final record was 2-2, and of course, there were many rumors at the time, Scott. I don't know if you remember this.
Yes, I do, very much.
Your boy.
Yep.
Triple H had a little thingy from Mrs.
Dropped the
Hattie.
Sledgehammer in her. Yep.
And it was a side piece, and Stephanie caught wind, and that's why they sent her packing. So I don't know what the whole staying true to her morals thing is. I mean, maybe he came on to her, and she, you know, shut him down, and they bumped her for that, or maybe they were getting it on, and so who knows. But, there are rumors, too, that she just was making moves on Triple H, trying to worm in, and he shut it down. So there's been different stories out there.
Yes, yep.
But they were linked one way or the other, and then she was gone, so... On August 25th, Heidenreich defeated Mercury by DQ in a singles match when Mercury hit him with a steel chair. A week later, Heidenreich pinned Mercury clean, but Eminem would take out the tag champs after the bout. On 9-9, during a special webcast portion of SmackDown, Animal and Heidenreich defeated Eminem cleanly and then beat him again by DQ a week later. So they really dominated much of this feud. Mm. On September 30th, Melina defeated Christy thanks to help from Eminem. They looked to do further damage after the bell. But Animal and Heidenreich made the save. Finally, on 10-7, Eminem hit the ring during an LOD match, assaulted the champs, and even took out Christy with a snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this is Heidenreich's last pay-per-view appearance. Him and Animal would lose the tag titles back to Eminem on the 10-28 SmackDown. Heidenreich stuck around with Animal for the remainder of the year, made one more appearance in January, was eventually released. The reason was unknown, but if you remember, it was believed he needed time to help his family rebound after Hurricane Katrina, because they lived in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember the story, like he didn't hear from them, or he thought they were missing, and he just went down there to like find them. And remember all the pictures like surfaced, like the memes of like him, you know, walking through the hurricane ravaged area.
Yeah.
So since that, he made appearances for some indie promotions, including WWC in Puerto Rico, winning their Universal Heavyweight title, and was last seen on the Hulkamania tour back in 2009, final record 2-4. And a guy I think that's actually gained, you know, a little, I don't want to say respect, but he was a little bit better than I remembered him being when rewatching these shows. Like, I never, I always thought he was just pretty useless, but he's actually had some pretty good charisma. I mean, he's had good charisma, and he's been, you know, pretty funny at times, and you know, the poetry stuff, and it's his face run. Well, his matches with Undertaker were more spirited than I remember them being, but even his face run has been pretty entertaining. And I remember hating it at the time that he was doing this LOD thing, but watching back in retrospect, it's again something else that it's not that bad, and a lot of it has to do with his energy. And I feel like he's a very 80s-ish kind of guy, limited in the ring, but a pretty cool look. And, like, a lot of charisma and easily connects with the crowd. Like, he had that, you know, bounding energy and bouncing around. And, you know, I feel like that carried him here. And I think he's a guy that if he was around in the late 80s in the WWF, he probably would have been, if not a bigger star, maybe a more, had more staying power. Like, I kind of, like a Hercules, you know what I mean? Something like that. Where he had that kind of charisma and hung around. And actually, probably more charisma than Hercules. But I just picture him in that role where he would have been around like 6-7 years, bouncing around face heel and fighting Hogan and teaming with Hogan, stuff like that. So what do you think? Kind of looking back, as Heide Reich, has your views of him changed rewatching these?
Yeah, a little bit. I did enjoy the Taker feud more than I thought. Again, I mean, he wasn't great shakes in the ring, but he served his purpose. He was a decent worker. I kind of like your theory about the whole late 80s thing. Like, I could see him being a guy that lasts through the 90s, being in DiBiase's corporation, facing Diesel, things like that, you know, facing Sean. I could see him definitely being a guy like that. I find it odd that he didn't stick around, because as we see, as this show progresses, SmackDown's roster was still a little, you know, still a little dearth of talent, although we do have a big pay-per-view debut on this show. Actually two, but one more important than the other. So I was a little surprised that they cut him loose, because I thought they needed the bodies, but I guess
It sounds like, I mean, I think it was his request. I don't think.
Right. Yeah. Well, that too. I'm surprised he never returned. Let's put it that way. I'm surprised they never like got feelers out to return. But yeah, we don't
remember. They didn't hear, like, people didn't hear from him for a long time. Remember when he went down there to find his family or whatever? He just like vanished, and then he finally resurfaced. But so anyway, back to the match. A solid feud going since the title switch. The women now in the mix. And I think this is a much better spot for Christy than with the Eugene stuff. It fits better. She looks good in the matching gear. And it's not some weird, creepy thing where she feels like she's, you know, taking sexual advantage of a mentally challenged person. So it feels a little bit better.
She looked good. She did look good that that
night. Oh, definitely.
Night,
and she this is good. The best she's looked even just in the ring. Like, you could tell she was learning and getting better. She wasn't too bad here. So LOD, a longer reign than expected, I thought, too. Because remember, they won it back in July, and they're still going strong.
Yeah.
Animal had a banged-up shoulder. He's all taped up. Like I mentioned earlier, Heide Reich still has some pretty good energy, and I liked his paint here, too. Like, he's really taking on the character pretty well.
Yes. Yeah, he had, like, that weird skull thing going. Yeah, that was cool.
So he paced Nitro, the big clothesline, Animal, and more on Animal, too. He started getting in better shape, I noticed. Like, that big gut he had back in July is starting to slim down a bit, so you can tell he's working himself back into ring shape. Crowd was really behind them here, too, just like they were in July. So Mercury kicks away at Animal's shoulder to turn the tide. Cole makes a good point about how that saps Animal's power game by working his shoulder over. Eminem gets a near fall, keep busting on the shoulder, kicks and snap offense. Crowd rallying Animal, but double team keeps him in check. Mercury is a nice neck breaker for two. Then he gets a scoop slam, but he can't make the tag. Heide Reich gets dumped to the floor. Melina tags herself in. Animal catches her and tags in Christy to a good pop. Christy hits the heart attack, and then she almost kills herself trying to do a hurricanrana. Animal hoists up Melina, and Christy hits the Doomsday Device, and that was a cool finish as LOD gets the win. And I thought it's a pretty fun opener. I was surprised Eminem lost, but they're doubling down here on LOD. And then, of course, Eminem wins it a couple weeks later. So I was a little surprised. I mean, on one hand, it makes sense. You want LOD to open the show with the big pop, and they've been pretty over. On the flip side, you would think with Eminem winning the titles back, you'd kind of maybe want it to win here. But they haven't seemed too interested in protecting Eminem that much. They just, I think they see them as a team that, I don't know, has credibility in a way, but
yeah.
So I thought the crowd was into it. It was a little bit worse than Bash, but I thought it was still a pretty good opener. And the crowd was rocking, and you know, I thought it was fine. And I've enjoyed this feud in LOD way more than I ever imagined.
Yeah, the match served its purpose. I mean, it was okay. It wasn't great. I will say that Christie's Doomsday Device was really good. She executed it well. You know, Melina didn't fall wrong or anything, and she landed good. Like it was, it looked good. It didn't look as much of a shit show as I thought as I remembered it being. Other than that, it was okay. I do think that they thought that Eminem was bulletproof, so they probably were like, "Eh." I mean, they're still pretty good heels, and I think everyone knew they were going to win the straps back at some point. So
I think it seems to seem. I don't know. I kind of agree with you, but I feel like that seems less likely as the time went on. You know, it was like you just kept assuming, but the more they lost, like losing again here, almost felt like, oh, maybe they're taking them out of the title picture and we'll get new contenders. You know, it was kind of weird how they kept losing and kind of getting dominated and then winning. So I feel like you had confidence you were going to win it back at some point, but as the losses piled up, that confidence was starting to wane a bit.
Hmm. I didn't think so. I think I was thinking, you know what? These guys, the tag division is still the shits on SmackDown. So my assumption was they were still the top heel team, and this is just a time eater and an opener for the show. I had a good feeling that Eminem was going to win it back, and because just the rest of the tag roster was still not great, and we've been lamenting about it all year. So
right, yeah. And Eminem was a shot in the arm, and I don't know. At the time, like I said, I was pretty upset that they lost LOD, but I mean, looking back, LOD was much more over than I expected, and you know, a lot of the justification too was the DVD was selling well, and they were trying to promote it and give Animal, you know, his brother was trying to hook him up a bit, so it made sense. But
yeah,
so there you go. That match is over, and we actually head backstage after that as Eddie Guerrero comes in to visit Batista, grudgingly wishes him luck, and Batista kind of plays things coy, and we'll talk about their interesting feud a bit later. But
yes, yep. So next up, we have the first of two big pay-per-view debuts,
mm-hmm.
With a character that was good for a while, but is slowly starting to, you know, wane. So give us the background on our first debut.
Bobby Lashley, born in Kansas, was a successful amateur wrestler and a U.S. Army Ranger during his formative years. He was training for the Olympics in 2003, but hurt his knee while doing business at a bank when a robbery broke out. With his Olympic hopes dashed, Lashley decided to try pro wrestling and signed a WWE developmental deal in late 2004, headed to OVW, where he was managed by and eventually feuded with Kenny Bolin, made his debut on September 23rd when he answered a Simon Dean open challenge and defeated him in under 3 minutes. The next week, Dean gave Lashley a Simon System protein shake to help him prepare for their rematch. Lashley stomped the shake in anger. And of course, Simon Dean is his opponent here. Good old Nova, who had his little run with the BWO. That's now done, so he's back to being Simon Dean.
Yep.
I think Meanie was gone at this point. Stevie went back to just whatever.
Cross-dressing.
Today. So I thought this was pretty funny. So Simon brings out a big platter of double cheeseburgers and then calls Houston a fat city, which is pretty true by all metrics. and said he would eat all the burgers if he loses. So he makes a promise. He guarantees a win. I thought Lashley had a great look. And I want to get your take on him in a minute, but and he was clearly set for a big push out of the gate. Used a lot of throws and suplexes early, missed a charge in the corner, and then Dean, another funny spot, Dean grabs a burger and throws it, and the referee gets distracted, and then he hits Lashley with the tray. Lashley no-sells, he rocks Simon with a headbutt. Lashley gets the Dominator for the easy squash win, and really quick and very effective, and it made sense to let Lashley go over strong. Dean is pretty useless, so whatever, have him squash him. This is what Dean is there for. It didn't linger or meander at all. They go right to the point, so that was good. They didn't really give Dean like a lot of, you know, sometimes they give these guys weird offense to drag the match out. I think we saw that in some of those 04 matches with the new guys. Here, mm-hmm. They don't do that. And then Lashley shoves a burger in his mouth, and then Simon Dean, in a match full of laughs for me, this is what the funniest. So he shoves a burger in his mouth, and then Simon just gets on his Segway and rolls off to the back after he recovers.
Yes.
A beaten man. So I don't know. I like this. I thought it was an effective squash. I thought, you know, Lashley got to show a little bit of his humorous side, the way he, you know, really demeaned and beat down Simon Dean. And I thought all the stuff Dean was doing was funny, too. So what did you think of the match? And then what did you think of Lashley as a prospect?
I mean, the match was effective. It served its purpose to put Lashley over. So that's all I'll say about that. I liked him a lot. I mean, you could tell clearly he was a Vince guy. You know, right. If you've been watching wrestling long enough, and we all know the kind of guys Vince has in his crosshairs, Pappy Lashley was certainly it. I mean, he was freaking jacked to the gills. He looked like a guy you knew just needed to kind of adapt to the pro wrestling style. I mean, he kind of knew how to do things in the... What? I'm complimenting you. Come on, Vince. He's definitely one of your guys. And you could tell he just needed to adapt to that kind of, you know, throw around pro wrestling style. I would like him a lot over time, particularly in when we get to like late 06 into 07. I really enjoyed his stuff. But you could tell he was very raw and needed to be molded a bit. And his promos weren't bad. I mean, as we're going to talk about, you see him intermittently throughout the rest of the show with shoving these burgers in Simon Dean's mouth. But you could tell that he was trying hard and, time needed to happen for him to adapt to the style of the WWE style of wrestling. It was fine. There's not much more to say about the match itself. It was a pretty effective squash.
Tell him hard right now.
Well, when you saw Lashley, Lord only knows. So that's it. I mean, it was an effective squash, and when we move on, and as you say, we'll see Lashley intermittently throughout the rest of the show.
Oh, how I like it!
Apparently, you did.
Big Vince guy. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, he did have a great look, and I think a lot of people were excited about him, and many were comparing him very early on to Brock Lesnar, just based on his look and his amateur style, and I think a lot of it was wishful thinking. You know, like.
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe we'll have another Brock at our hands because everyone wanted Brock back so badly. I mean, there were even, some places in the internet calling him Black Lesnar, if you remember that. But
yes.
I mean, there were comparisons to that early. We'll see if they bear themselves out. But I think people were just hopeful based on his look and amateur skill set that maybe they had lucked into the next Lesnar. But as we know, there's only one Brock. So. All right. So backstage again, JBL's being interviewed, talks about a potential Raw invasion that's been hinted at. And again, the brand war really at its apex here. Lots of hate between the sides. Ray comes in and talks about their match, and he gives JBL a mask to wear after his loss. But JBL says no. So Ray says, well, your assistant Jillian needs it more. And we'll talk about why later. But it was kind of a douche thing for the purest of baby faces, Ray Mysterio, to say.
I know, pretty much.
Right? I mean, it was pretty douchey. But we'll talk about why in a little bit. But
yep.
Not something you'd expect Ray to say.
No. No. It was pretty funny. But... we'll talk more about that match when we get to it, because I got some surprising comments about that match. So, next up, our first title match of the evening, JR. The United States Championship is on the line in a fatal four-way. As we mentioned, our champion is Mr. Chris Benoit. But pretty much all the top-flight mid-card guys are all in this match.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them we will not see on pay-per-view again for quite a while. Who
right.
is that?
This is Christian's final pay-per-view match since 2009. His contract expires at October 31st. He decided not to renew, wanted to take some time off to recharge his batteries. He would appear at Taboo Tuesday, and that's what I referenced before that we'll talk about, and wrestled his final match on the 11-4 SmackDown. And that recharging period, Scott, did not last very long because he appeared in TNA at their Genesis pay-per-view on November 13th, a week later. He would remain in TNA until late 2008. We'll talk about him more at that point. Really one of the first guys to make a serious move to TNA from WWE. There's been guys that have ended up in TNA, but I think Christian is one of the first to really, like, you know, on his own, leave the company and then go to TNA. And it was kind of seen as like a big win at the time, because again, we just went through this whole summer of Christian kind of gotten forgotten, getting, misused and getting buried and losing a lot of matches that many thought he should win and not being, just utilized properly based on his talent. So a lot of people saw this as a big coup for TNA to get someone of Christian's caliber and looking to maybe, use him in a different way and in more of a main event championship way. And they would. So one of the few guys, I think, during the run of TNA that was better off and benefited from, I think, his run in TNA than at least staying in WWE. I mean, his early WWE stuff, he did well. And overall, he was pretty fairly protected. But at this point, when he got super over, they did not use him as well as they probably should have, and he made them pay by leaving. And a lot of people were surprised, too, that he would have walked and said, I think they wanted to re-sign him, and he said no.
Well, he didn't want to be in the role he was going to be paid for, which is meandering around the SmackDown mid-card.
Right, because he couldn't have thought any push was coming, right?
Right.
I mean,
no, obviously not.
When you look at it, it's like, if he wasn't going to get pushed earlier in 05 when he was super red hot over and they needed guys to face Cena or Batista and he didn't, like, what would make him think it would be coming after that at that point?
Absolutely. His chance their opening for him was between, you know, May and July, those 3 months, even into August, where you could have put him in a feud with. He easily could have been in that feud with Cena instead of Jericho. Very easily.
Or even Batista instead of JBL, you know?
Right.
Instead of doing two matches, I think we talked about this. Why not have Batista beat JBL at the Bash and then beat Christian at SummerSlam? Like, that could have worked, too.
Yeah, why did you need a rematch? No, you're right. And I think he said, you know what? TNA seems to be fledgling. They, you know, maybe they think bringing me in would be a, you know, I'd be a hot commodity, and they would use me effectively. And for one of the few times in their history, they did.
But I am curious. I mean, I know we have to, I guess, check back at the observers of the time or whatever. But I am curious if he knew he was going to TNA, or was he, you know, was he legitimately serious about the recharging my batteries thing, and then TNA called him after he got released and he decided to go. Like, I'm curious if he lied and already was planning to go there, or if they hit him up after he left and then he said, screw it, all right, I'll do it.
I have a feeling it was a surprise thing. Like, I don't think he planned it out. I think he loved being in WWE. He maybe wanted to. Maybe he thought to himself, look, if I leave the company for a while, you know, out of sight, out of mind, maybe I can make a big return in a few years when maybe they need some main event guys.
Right.
And maybe I will get pushed. Maybe I just need to be away for a while.
And there is value in that thought. I mean, you hear it many companies, like, you know, the best way to get promoted sometimes is to leave and come back, right? I mean, so I think there is, you know, truth in that statement to say, yeah, sometimes you get to leave and then they miss you and you get, you know, you do well somewhere else and then they'll pay bigger for you to come back. So,
yeah,
I think, you know, that's definitely possible. So,
he had to know. Let me just get this quick point. He had to know, obviously, when they were a tag team in 2000, 2001, that just based on charisma, Edge was the more bankable guy at the time. Now, I know a lot of people. There's a few people that I used to know that were wrestling fans who always thought Christian was the better wrestler than Edge. And that's – you could make that argument in some cases. But clearly, Edge just had that thing. And, of course, you know, Poke and Lita didn't hurt. And at least in terms of being a smarmy heel and a good main event guy, Christian just doesn't – I just don't think he was ever taken seriously. I think the thing that killed him – when he was in 03 into 04, mostly in 03, when he had the opportunity, and he was feuding with Booker, if you remember, on Raw for the IC belt, but he still had – remember, we were like, when is he going to change his outfit? And I think everybody still remembers him with the long hair and the stupid fishnet shirt and all that shit. And it never really left him. And you think that the feud he had with Jericho, you know, through WrestleMania and the beginning, the first half of 04, was really going to catapult him. And it really never did. But you thought it would, because
remember,
he got hurt. That's what killed him. He got hurt, too.
Yeah, but he came back, and, I mean, they started to give him a little bit of a push in early 05. I mean, he was in the feud with Cena and Jericho.
Right.
But it was right at his peak in that summer that they said, screw it. They had him lose and then kicked him over to SmackDown. And then you're thinking, okay, you know, here we go. Maybe he'll mix it up with Batista. And then Batista, like, squashed him on an episode of SmackDown, pretty much. And then that was it. So it seemed like maybe they were going to push him.
You thought so, but again, instead of having Christian, I mean, so instead of realizing that the Bash, you're like, ah, Batista, JBL.
Right.
Instead, they're like, well, we have to have a rematch because that's just the way the way things are booked. That's how life is. That's booking 101. And so instead of thinking outside the box and doing that, and Christian instead is forgotten, and this is what happens. So it's unfortunate. There's a lot of, theories you could put out there, you know, as to why he, you know, why it happened, but he'll be missed.
Unfortunate. So on September 9th, the new SmackDown talent Ken Kennedy tried to create some dissension backstage by asking Charmel why Chris Benoit had yet to grant Booker T a U.S. title shot. The next week, Christian and Orlando Jordan defeated Benoit and Booker in a tag match with Christian pinned Benoit. On 9/16, Charmel helped Booker defeat Christian in a singles match, and later that night, she told Booker he was being held down and he needed to take the title shot, not wait to be given one. On 9/30, Orlando Jordan defeated Christian and Booker in a triple threat, and GM Teddy Long told Benoit he could choose his No Mercy opponent after watching the bout. Benoit would wind up choosing to fight all three men in a triple threat match. Booker T would defeat OJ a week later, again thanks to Charmel getting involved, and after the bout he would chastise his wife for cheating, and eventually this was made into a four-way for the title. So I guess a little bit of tension in the Booker T family. And yes, he does get that nice hometown pop, still with Charmel, like I mentioned. Christian still hanging in the mid-card, evaporating day by day. OJ still lingering. It seemed like maybe he'd fade at SummerSlam, but he's still hanging on. And Benoit has dominated Jordan since SummerSlam. A big pop for Benoit, gets knocked to the floor. Christian and Jordan team up until Booker wipes them both out and gets heated up. Christian yanks Booker to the floor, but Benoit slides in and gets a crossface on Jordan that Christian makes a save on. Benoit is just machine-like, mowing through Jordan and Christian, and it basically becomes a tornado tag at this point. And then Booker comes in, hits a missile dropkick on Christian, starts to beat on Jordan until Benoit knocks him out. Benoit and Booker are left alone, and they have a big stare down to a pop. Jordan interjects, and Benoit gets knocked to the floor. Booker and Orlando double clothesline, and then Benoit and Christian both go to the top turnbuckle and start fighting. Booker falls into the corner, and they both fall to the floor. Booker gets a super close near fall on a roll-up, and then starts getting red hot from there, mowing through everyone, gets a big pop on the spin-a-rooney, hits a scissors kick on Jordan, but Christian makes a save. And I thought there was really good energy here. I thought Booker looked great. You could tell he was starting to get rejuvenated a bit with this whole, you know, working with his wife and getting into the title mix. Benoit hits the Germans on Christian, but Jordan blocks the third before getting chucked to the floor and getting slammed into Booker. Benoit hits three more Germans on Christian, but misses the headbutt. Jordan makes a save on Christian again, but Benoit puts Christian in the sharpshooter for the win. I thought this was a really fun, spirited match, a lot of quick-paced action. All four guys had time to shine. They all looked good. I thought it was a strong win for Benoit, who keeps rolling and dominating. Jordan has improved, too. He didn't look out of place with these three other guys, which is, you know, speaks volumes for how far he's come. And I think it's a good match for Christian in a swan song. It sucks that he's leaving, but he went out with a really good performance. And then after the match, Charmel berates Booker, blames Benoit for his loss, saying they aren't friends, and Booker starts to needs to start listening to her when it comes to his career. So we'll talk about more on that in a bit. What did you think about Jordan? What did you think about the match, and what did you think about Jordan? Did he look better to you? I mean, it only makes sense with the guys he's been working with over the last 3 months that he'd start to improve a little bit. Did he improve in your eyes, and what did you think of the match as a whole?
The match wasn't bad. It was solid. I mean, you have four good workers. And saying that, Orlando Jordan did fit in because you have three experienced guys in the ring. And OJ definitely showed that these 3 months that he worked with Benoit paid off. He definitely looked like he fit. I always kind of liked Orlando's swagger, you know, even dating back when he was in the cabinet. So I definitely think he learned a lot, and he fit in with this group. Booker needed to get rejuvenated because it just seemed like he was just starting to look very old and out of place. So we hadn't seen him a lot. Was he even at WrestleMania? No, he wasn't even at WrestleMania. So he seemed kind of out of place, and which is weird for this, you know, and I keep harping on this, but it's the truth. The struggles on this SmackDown roster. You would think Booker looked a lot better, and he really didn't. But yeah, like you said, this is where they're like, look, we have a guy here who's a bona fide talent, and we're kind of, you know, we don't really know what the hell to do with him. Let's do this. But this is where Michael Cole starts struggling tonight. I know people seem to forget the circumstances. They just remember the series, and it was mentioned twice, and he screwed it up both times. Number one, they were not feuding over the WCW US title. It was the TV title. Mm-hmm. And number two, the series wasn't actually for the title. It was to be the number one contender to face Belfast Bruiser. He did it.
Right. And in his defense, and I mean, he should know, but those are two very common misconceptions by a lot of fans. I mean, that a lot of people always say that was for the title. And I've heard like US title a lot for that too.
Right.
That said, I mean, he should have gotten it right. There's no reason for him not to get it.
He should have. Well, the fact that Reigns, and I blame whoever's, I don't know if it was Vince or whoever, but after he fucked it up the first time, somebody in his ear should have said no and then had him do it again, but he didn't. He said the same thing.
Right.
In any event, back to your question. I think Orlando definitely has grown as a worker in these 3 months because he definitely fit. I think he did anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think it made for a good match. And Christian's, one thing you'll say about Christian, regardless of his level of the card, he never takes a match off. Christian always looks good.
Right.
And he'll always give you his 100%. So you'll always get Christian at his best, regardless of where in the card he is. So I enjoyed the match a lot. I honestly thought Booker was going to win here back then. And he was going to stay a babyface, and then we'd go down the line with what would happen. So I actually thought Booker was going to win here and pin like Christian or somebody and not pin Benoit. So I was a little surprised, actually, when I remember watching it back the first time back then, that Benoit retained. I really thought he was going to – because I was thinking, honestly, thinking about feuds and stuff, I thought they were going to get Benoit in a program with Batista.
Right.
Which would have been really good, I think. So I thought Booker was actually going to win this match and win the title. I was surprised back then that I thought that Benoit retained. I didn't think he was going to. I thought Benoit was going to beat – or Booker was going to pin one of the other two, probably Christian. And then Benoit was going to move on into a main event program. That's what I was thinking. But having said that, though, the match was good. I enjoyed it. And, yeah, I think Orlando has improved. Mm-hmm. So Chris Benoit retains the United States Championship in a pretty good match, Fatal 4-Way.
We head backstage again because Bobby Lashley forcing Simon Dean to continue to eat those cheeseburgers.
Yes.
And I try, but I can't fight it. Oh, you're dancing real close.
And what we keep forgetting is, so mind you, as we said during the match, Simon Dean flipped all the burgers on the ground and tried to whack.
Right.
So these burgers have been on the ground. They've been stepped on. In fact, I don't know if it's this clip. He's biting into a burger and he pulls a hair out. The burgers are all disgusting. It was funny. It was funny. I give Simon Dean props for that, for putting that segment over. And Lashley. All right, next up, JR, our second big debut of the evening. You already mentioned him in a fun fact earlier. Give us some backgrounds on Mr. KK, and not the KK you and I know, but another KK.
Mr. Ken Anderson grew up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where he announced basketball games in high school. It was there that he began announcing players' last names twice in a dramatic fashion, a gimmick he eventually carried over to his wrestling career. After spending time as a security guard and a personal trainer and a stint in the U.S. Army, he began training to become a wrestler in 1999. Between 01 and 04, he spent time doing jobs on dirty syndicated programs. After contract negotiations fell apart with TNA, he finally signed on with WWE in February of 05, was assigned to OVW. Shortly after, he was brought up to Velocity as Ken Anderson, and at Paul Heyman's urging, he referred to himself as Mr. Anderson and began dramatically announcing himself, repeating his last name twice like he had done all those years earlier. Before moving to SmackDown, he was renamed Ken Kennedy to eliminate any links to the Anderson wrestling family. He made his SmackDown debut on 8/25, defeating Funaki. Over the following weeks, he would get into arguments with announcer Tony Chimmel, leading to Kennedy's trademark self-ring announcements. On September 30th, Kennedy and JBL defeated Rey Mysterio and Hardcore Holly in a tag match. Holly took the pin from JBL after Kennedy distracted him at ringside. On 10/7, Kennedy came to ringside as Holly was wrestling Sylvain. After the match, he hit Holly with a microphone and announced Holly as the loser of the match. I remember seeing Kennedy on Velocity when I was working at Ascent, at your company, because I used to work Saturday nights a lot, I think still at that point. So it was it would be on, and I remember really digging the gimmick at first, and I remember watching the show because this is the first one since I moved back to Rhode Island, and began ordering them and watching with Mr. Flanagan and our buddy Jim, and we were just like going crazy that night, like imitating the Mr. Kennedy thing. And I know eventually got old, and we'll cover him as we move along his issues. Right. But on this night, the gimmick, the look, the idea all seemed really, really fresh. Like it wasn't dated or blah yet. You know, like it was still. Right. Really cool, I thought. And I thought it was unique, and it made him stand out. And he certainly had the pipes to do it. So I thought
probably definitely
really good. Also, just one other fun fact. In 9-1, Sylvain made his SmackDown debut with a brand new look, of course. Sylvain Grenier was the former La Resistance. Gone was the French sympathizer garb and gimmick in its place. It was the role of a narcissistic French model that came to the ring to techno music. Sylvain defeated Holly on 10/7, but as we'll see, we'll talk about him again in a few minutes here. So they're not giving up on Sylvain Grenier yet, even with La Rez being done. Before we talk about the match, what did you think of Kennedy, your initial impressions?
I liked it a lot. He was a breath of fresh air. He was needed for the roster, as I keep saying. He looked and acted like he fit. He didn't. There's one thing that Lashley didn't have was that automatic charisma that he had to work on. Like, Lashley still felt like a pseudo-outsider, whereas Kennedy acted like he belonged there already.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised he didn't go to TNA, to be honest with you. They probably really lowballed him.
Well, he didn't really have much bankable.
True, that's true.
Yet, you know.
But I wasn't sure if TNA was... Yeah, and their roster at the time was jacked full of guys, so...
Yeah, I mean, there was more of a hole in SmackDown in many ways, you know?
Yeah, no, he fit perfectly. And like I said, I think he just seemed so confident on the roster that Lashley just quite didn't have yet, which he would, but he didn't have it yet, that Kennedy did. So that's why I think he's a little higher on the card. He was a couple of matches higher on the card.
Yeah, no, he definitely had the star potential. I mean, I think that, you know, that's there. You can see it. So the influx of talent continues on SmackDown. He does a good heel shtick on the mic. He talks shit and puts himself over before the match. Kennedy had gut in Holly's face, like I mentioned, cost him that match on SmackDown. Holly's aggressive to start. He hits Kennedy with some pretty stiff clubbing blows. Kennedy tries to come back, but Holly punishes him with chops. Kennedy runs Holly into the post to turn the tide and works the arm with an armbar. Holly tries some chops, but Kennedy goes back to the arm. Holly gets desperate, hits a sidewalk slam for two. Holly battles back with a one-armed clothesline and a sloppy pancake, followed by a draping kick to the gut. Holly shrugs off a wheel kick and lands a boot to the face, and he seems to be sandbagging just a little bit. I don't know if you get that feeling as well, or if it's just, I don't know if my guard is up on it with Holly, because you just kind of know he does it. But Kennedy catches Holly on the top rope and hits a Green Bay plunge off the middle rope for the win. You know, this is fine. It was stiff. It was good enough to keep Kennedy chugging along undefeated. Holly has good selling, but kind of the weird spots blended in, and again, he looked like he was stiffing him a little bit and sandbagging him a bit. Kennedy, and I think this will bear out over time as well, he's kind of more over for his speaking antics, but the ring work was kind of passable enough to at least supplement it.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, I mean, again, basically a semi-squash, and Kennedy looks strong. And after the match, Holly's selling the arm and ribs with the medics. Sylvain comes out, attacks Holly, kicks and punches him in the ribs in the ring, and then leaves. So I thought it was decent to put over Sylvain. I thought the modeling persona mannerisms were over-exaggerated and funny enough. I don't know how much potential he had as a star, but they continue his feud with Holly here. What did you think of the match? Do you think it was effective enough for Kennedy?
It was, and I agree with you. I think he was. I just think Holly's a douche. So I do think he was. He, for some reason, has this – I don't know what his problem was, but he just seemed to have this persona like, hey, I'm the one who's got to put the rookies through their paces. Like, who the fuck are you? Like, what did you ever do? I mean, I know you went through the era, but it's not like you were the Austin or something, for Christ's sakes. So he definitely – there was a couple of moments in the middle of the match where he did chop him pretty stiff and then kind of didn't let – Kennedy help, with moves and stuff. The plunge,
right.
was really good.
Right. It looked more like that than the stiffing to me. More of the kind of sandbagging him.
He was not moving him, like helping him move the match along. He was kind of like being, he wasn't really stiffing him, but he was not very cooperative.
Right.
But the match was good. And Kennedy's charisma and his promo skills are good. He's not horrendous in the ring. I mean, he's a pretty basic worker. You know, it's a lot of strikes and stuff. I think the finisher, I think the Green Bay plunge looks really good. So I had no problem with the match. I obviously was a different kind of feud than Ken. There are more upper heels on the SmackDown roster to where, because I'm sure people are thinking, well, how come, Kennedy had to earn this long match, but, Lashley got a squash? Well, there was less, low mid card scrub heels than there were.
I think it comes down to just style. I mean, Lashley's more conducive to being a big power guy to just mowing through someone, whereas Kennedy's going to work a little bit harder to pick up a win. And Holly's more established than Simon. So I think it comes down more to the style of Kennedy versus Lashley.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, and Kennedy, Kennedy Holly, I thought, attempted to work well together, but Holly, I think, did break his balls. The after thing, I was never been a Sylvain guy, and I think the gimmick was crap, but whatever. Again, I probably shouldn't split hairs because I've just been constantly saying that the roster sucked, so bodies were needed. Mm-hmm. So that's fine. I was cool with it. I like the glasses. They were nice. The glasses were cool. That jacket was terrible, but yes. I like the glasses though.
It's quite the duster.
So, Mr. Kennedy. With his first pay-per-view win.
Be my wifey, yeah,
Yes, I'll be your wifey.
Backstage, Simon Dean still shoving burgers in his mouth as Lashley oversees him. And then elsewhere, Charmel berates Booker for being a loser again, while Benoit's a winner and a champion. Booker blew his shot because Benoit stole it. Kennedy interrupts, puts over his win, and rubs it in on Booker, which was pretty funny. And then Charmel tells Booker he's his own problem, not Benoit. So they continue that. Kennedy's kind of wedging, and Booker is starting to maybe hit the end of his rope as his wife continues to taunt him over his issues with Benoit. So we'll see how that preys on Booker's psyche as we move along.
Did you call him a loser?
He's a loser!
He's a loser! So next up, JR, probably one of the one half of the main event for this show. This feud continues to move on. We're on its like seventh month, I think. How did we get this far?
Well, Jillian Fletcher, I guess we should mention first, made her debut in 1998 after training under David Fit Finley. She worked the indie circuit in 2003 when she joined OVW and adopted the name Jillian Hall. During her time in OVW, she would have roles as a wrestler and a manager, as both a face and a heel. On 7/28, she was brought to SmackDown in the role of Fixer for Eminem, but the hook was that she had a grotesque mole on the side of her face, and the mole, of course, was an awful fake prosthetic that took up most of her face. It was there pretty much for laughs. After assisting Eminem, JBL met with her and asked her to become his image consultant, a role that she accepted, and she accompanies him to the ring here against Rey Mysterio. And if you remember, a lot of the gimmick was based on Austin Powers 3, where Fred Savage had the mole, and they were
mole.
Like, yeah, you know, like it was grossly there that you couldn't help but look at it and try not to talk about it, and that's pretty much where the whole gimmick came from. But Jillian's was like, you know, with the typical creativity of WWE, is like super over the top. It's just right. Huge, clearly fake thing like glued to the side of her face. So that was kind of silly, but you know, JBL's always better when he has some kind of entourage with him. And Taz just rips the mole apart, makes fun of jokes about Jillian and the mole. JBL carries his presence to the mid-card, and, you know, I think it speaks to the work he did building up his credibility that, to me, he felt like a main eventer mixing it up with these other guys rather than a now-demoted mid-carder. So for a long time, he felt like a mid-carder as champion, but to me now the role is reversed, and he feels like a main eventer in the mid-card. Do you feel that way?
Yes. Obviously, his main event time is over, so
right.
He needed a spot, and this was kind of a good spot for him. Mm-hmm. Considering the burgeoning feud that was beginning between the two shows, there needed to be a spot for him. So, and I want to say try main event. I said dual main event. Obviously, there's two other matches that are just as big as that, but I wanted to say. But yeah, I agree.
So Ray comes out hot with right hands. He takes the fight right to the bully. JBL grinds with a headlock to slow him down. Ray escapes and makes JBL chase him around to wear him out, rubbing it in with jumping jacks and a baseball slide dropkick, and JBL is completely flustered here. He uses a Jillian distraction to take over. Ray wriggles free again and starts to pepper the leg, but JBL starts to get hurt from that. Keeps him grounded. Very sharp offensive plan from Ray so far. JBL spills to the floor. Ray hits a bulldog off the apron, but JBL is able to trip Ray on the steps, and Ray falls and smacks his head. That was a pretty cool spot. Ray tries to punch his way back in, but JBL gets a fallaway slam from the middle rope to cut him down, and then gets another fallaway slam, and then a third one on the floor. So really working the back of Ray. Hooks in a bear hug to work the lower back some more. JBL releases, but Ray hits a tornado DDT, makes one last comeback flurry, punching away and hitting a Bronco Buster. Jillian gets on the apron, but attempt fails. Ray gets a top rope moonsault for a close near fall. Blocks the clothesline from hell with a dropkick and hits a 619, but JBL ducks the West Coast pop and then hits a big clothesline from hell for the win. I thought this was a good match. I thought it had really good timing. They had good chemistry. The heat segment was well done. There were a lot of teases and comebacks, and I thought both guys looked good, and I thought seeing JBL mix it up with other guys outside of just defending his title, you know, against a steady parade of challengers was good. I thought this was a pretty sneaky, good match. Again, these guys have pretty good chemistry. They work well together. I like the big man, little man thing, and I think it's been one of JBL's better matches during this run.
I agree 100%. This was the surprise for me. This match was a lot of fun. I think the size difference made for good storytelling. You know, JBL, you knew that if he was going to win, the clothesline from hell was going to be sold like crazy because Ray would fly up in the air like he, you know, like he hit a pillow. And it made for a fun psychology match. I didn't think Ray was going to lose here, I'll be honest with you. But I'm sure they wanted to keep JBL relatively stable.
I think we see that a lot with JBL during, like, I know we saw it enough with his championship reign, but I feel like we see it again now in the mid card where mm-hmm. you keep kind of waiting for them to go honky with him and have him start losing, you know, like Honky Tonk Man did, where he started paying yep. back with all his losses. You kind of wait for that to come.
Right.
And it doesn't really, he wins a bunch, as we'll see. Yeah. So, and that starts here. But I agree with yep. you. I thought Ray was going to win this one too. But
after
JBL.
Particularly after the Eddie feud, I was surprised. Right. Yeah, I was surprised.
Yeah, hard fought match. Like you said, definitely a surprise.
Yeah, no, it definitely surprised me. I think the big man, little man combo worked out well here. So JBL gets the surprise win after Ray wins the big feud at SummerSlam with Eddie.
Do you feel like that was kind of a waste now that they just have him lose to?
Yeah, honestly, I do.
Well, I guess Eddie had beaten Ray on SmackDown, right? Didn't they have one last match on SmackDown where he finally beat him?
Yeah, and it wasn't like a regular feud for a belt or anything. I mean, really the purpose of the feud was so Ray could have his kid back.
Right.
So after that, I was like, whatever. Let's go on back to regular wrestling. So it was almost like it was just a snapshot. Almost like Shawn and Hogan.
Right.
Like just a snapshot for that show, and let's move on.
Although
like,
Ray dominated that feud pretty much. He won all the matches, though.
Yeah, he did. You know, because that was the whole story. And then eventually, I don't remember what date it was. I think it was maybe two SmackDowns after SummerSlam, I think. Or sometime in September, he probably. Yeah. I think it was a cage match.
Yep.
I think Eddie finally beat him. So there is JBL gets the win match longer than I thought, almost 13 and a half minutes. It was a longer match than I thought it was going to be. But a lot of the early matches have all been relatively short. So, all right, next up, the other second, third of our main event, probably one of the bigger two main event matches, feud that has been continuing on since, you know, pretty much since February, March. And this was the match I was referring to earlier. How do we get to this point, and how do we add guys the guys into the mix to make this a three-person match?
On September 16th, Undertaker and Randy Orton faced off at a SummerSlam rematch. Taker would win, but during the bout, Cowboy Bob brought a casket out, and inside was Undertaker's image. A week later, the Ortons rolled the casket out again, but this time the real Undertaker was inside. He popped out, threw Randy in it, and knocked it over. The Ortons escaped, but Teddy Long set up a pay-per-view match, and on September 30th, Taker defeated Bob Orton in his first WWE match since 1987. Finally, on October 7th, Roddy Piper returned to confront his former running buddy and would battle the Ortons in a handicap match. During the bout, Taker's gong sounded, distracting the Ortons and leading Piper to roll up Cowboy for the win. Druids then brought a casket down, and this one contained images of the Ortons. Taker would appear in the ring behind them, but the Ortons got out of dodge before he could strike. And again, this is Orton's first pay-per-view match since WrestleMania 3 when he teamed with Don Morocco against the Can-Am Connection.
Losers.
And while this match is referenced as the first-ever handicap casket match multiple times, that is, again, incorrect, Scott. Like you mentioned earlier, some incorrect information. Mm-hmm. On the 9/23/99 SmackDown, Viscera and Midian defeated Triple H in this exact type of match, a handicap casket match.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, feud continues, I guess. Mm-hmm. Makes sense. With Orton having won at SummerSlam. And it seemed like maybe this could be it. Or maybe we'll continue. We'll see. Orton continues to be rebuilt as a heel threat. Cowboy's out in his Canadian tuxedo instead of the tights, which I thought was kind of weird, with the jean shirt tucked into the jeans.
Yes.
Big entrance for their casket and for Taker, lending a big mash feel to this. Taker fends off Bolt to start until a low blow takes him down. The Ortons double team until Taker recovers. He chucks Randy towards the casket to spook him. Taker dumps Cowboy in the casket, but he escapes. That allows Randy to shoot Taker into the steps. Taker survives the first casket attempt and strikes his way back into the match. Lots of punch and kick offense from all sides to start off. Taker hits old school on Randy and an STO on Randy as well, gaining some momentum. Taker tries old school on Cowboy, but Randy trips him up. The Ortons hit a double superplex. I thought that was a really cool spot. And, of course, that was one of Cowboy Bob's moves back in the day.
Yep.
And they hit that nicely. Taker blocks a double suplex into the casket and DDTs both men and then hits a snake eyes on Randy. A quick series of reversals ends with a Randy Orton inverted backbreaker while Cowboy finds a fire extinguisher. Taker knocks Orton into the casket with a chair shot and then chokes out Cowboy with a triangle and eventually drags him as well, but Randy blocks the lid. Randy makes a comeback, hits a power slam, and drags him to the casket, but Cowboy's still in there. He starts to freak out. That allows Taker to hit a low blow. Taker heats up, but Randy mows him down with a desperation dropkick. Taker hits a last ride on Randy, but when he opens the casket, Cowboy Bob pops up and sprays the extinguisher in his face. that gives Randy the chance to hit the RKO. I thought that was a cool sequence, something you didn't fully expect, and they you know, booked it well. Taker recovers, but Randy bashes him with an extinguisher. With the extinguisher, can't close the door. Taker pulls Randy in, and Cowboy slams the door from behind, not realizing that Randy was in there too. The door pops open, and Undertaker's choking Randy. Cowboy grabs him. Randy bashes Taker with a chair, and they pick up the win by locking him in the casket. So Randy Orton again beats the Undertaker. They wheel the casket to the aisle and then hack it up with an axe and light it on fire. And on the surface, this was pretty good heel stuff to continue the feud, but pretty over the top, you know. And I guess it's par for the course with Taker, and we've seen worse. Mm-hmm. I thought the first half of the match had too much striking. It was pretty bland, but I thought it picked up once they got the deeper offense back and forth. And once Cowboy kind of got taken out of things and they let Randy and Taker go at it, I thought the match really picked up. And I thought the finish was well done, too, with the fire extinguisher and the RKO and then the chair shot. Orton gets another win. And I want your take on this in a moment, that he keeps needing help to beat Taker. But I feel like it's okay here because, it, you know, his character is kind of built that way. So, you know, talk about that in a minute. Not their best match together, solid enough. And what did you think of the fire as well? Because I thought it was kind of hokey because they pushed the casket all the way to the end, and it's clearly like a gimmicked tarp. You know what I mean? Like, it's obvious that they're putting it over a blanket.
Yep.
And then the fact that they try to attempt to murder this guy, and, like, no one comes to help at all. It's like, at least have some officials come out and they fend him off with the axe or something. Like, no one goes near it, and they're just standing there watching the casket burn. Not one person tried to make a save until the Ortons leave, and then they come out with the fire extinguishers. Like, I don't know. Whatever. I know, suspend belief, but, like, some of that was just too much for me. The obvious blanket that they push him onto, the fact that they try to murder the guy via fire, and, like, nobody shows any interest in helping him.
I know.
And then also, so talk about that, and then talk about what you thought about Orton needing so much nonsense at Cowboy Bob to beat Taker twice now.
Well, I'll answer your second question first. The it's Taker, so any feud with Taker, usually rules don't apply. Usually. And Orton's a smarmy little prick, so it's okay that he needs his dad and he needs I still think it legitimizes him. I mean, he's beaten Taker twice in 3 months, so he needed help. Everybody needs fucking help. It's Taker. So in that, when it comes logically, I don't think it's a problem. And it's cool seeing Cowboy Bob wrestling, you know? It's Cowboy Bob. And he was somewhat maneuverable. I mean, you know, he's been his, I don't know, at that point he was obviously in his, you know, late 50s, early 60s probably. But I had no issue with it. And I think it's good for the storyline because it's Taker. You always need help to be Taker. It's Taker. And because Orton is that kind of smarmy douche, it works fine. So that part I have no problem with. The last part was a bit much. Now, I know it happened at, you know, Rumble 98 when Kane, you know, set the... But that's Kane. That's his brother. Fire. It fits. This was just... This was a little over the top. And, I mean, they dumped that whole can. I mean, that thing was... At least Kane and Paul Bearer just lit the top of the casket on fire. These guys, like, almost burned the building down. Right. It's like... The fire was ridiculous. Yeah, it was that was a bit much. And then, you know, let's let the thing burn for a while. Oh, and then we'll have a couple guys come out and put the fire out. You know, it's like, let's wait till Taker's dead, and then we'll put the fire out.
Yeah, it was. That was like a little bit much for me.
Yeah, I mean, suspend disbelief is one thing, but when it literally makes zero sense, then you have to think to yourself, all right, guys, come on. You have an axe there. Have them wave it at the, you know, the guys or whatever. At least make some attempt. So that part was a little redonkulous, but I thought the match was 50-50, you're right. I think early on was a little slow and a lot of punching and stuff. But the storytelling picked up probably like 8 or 9 minutes in, and probably the last like 10 minutes of the match was pretty good in that aspect. Good storytelling, but it's Cowboy Bob. He's a veteran. He knows, kind of helps the story along. And the end was great. The only part that was dumb was Orton, Cowboy Bob missed a cue. The time when Orton drags, when Taker brings Orton into the casket before Bob closes it, Taker's in the casket. I think it's after he gets hit with the fire extinguisher, and Orton's like lunging for the cover, And he's like telling the refs, help, help, give me the cover. And the refs are like giving him the cover to close. It's like,
right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where the fuck are you, Bob?
Right, yeah, like, he was supposed to help him close it.
Yeah, it was like so stupid. He had to actually have like the refs cheat for him.
Well, Bob looked winded and out of it when he was looking for that fire extinguisher. You could tell he was like hurting from being out there. But
But so that part was funny. But the last like 10 minutes of the match I thought was really good. You're right. The beginning, I think they were trying to feel themselves out and kind of Bob was trying
to definitely the third. I'd rank it third so far. I think they've gone diminishing. Like Mania was their best. Than SummerSlam than here.
Yeah.
And I point to the Mania match too, where Orton really hung in and almost pulled it out to show that to me, like having to cheat to win is not a big deal. And again, it's his character. He's built that way. He's a smarmy douche heel that doesn't give a fuck. So to me, he's built like he'll rub in the win either way. Like he doesn't need a clean win. What I'm trying to say is he's been protected and built enough that he doesn't need clean wins now over Undertaker to really make him mean anything. Like the heel run enough was enough to reboot him. Like his win over Benoit, his win over Mick Foley, you know, stuff like that to me has been enough to legitimize Randy Orton at this point.
I agree. Yeah, no, exactly. And so it's fine. I don't think there's any question that that Orton is legit. And I think he's, after the shitstorm of late 04, 05 into early 05, I think he's kind of rebounded a little bit. So Randy Orton wins with the help of his pop, and we know that one more match is probably in the offing at some point. But obviously this is a taker time off thing, clearly.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about this feud in a few, you know, few vaults. Mm-hmm. All right, why don't we take a break, JR? Two matches left, both championship matches, including our main event. But first, many words from somewhere.
Because.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tourneaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Scott Hudson, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast with Scott and Justin.
All right, Nation, we're back. Want to quickly talk about PlayStation.com before we finish things up. Scott, we had a new Vintage Vault refresh up today, Saturday's main event, looking at April 30th, 1988. Mm-hmm. So check that out. Of course, the first show post-WrestleMania 4. Yep. A new episode of Sports Evolution, the Cowboys. Speaking of Cowboy Bob, we had Cowboy Morissette and Cowboy Sr.
Yes.
Joined by former NFL wide receiver Rob Carpenter back on the show.
Yep.
And they talked a little Broncos-Panthers Super Bowl, which is this Sunday. And they talked a little PC Friars, which I'm not going to talk about right now because I'm pissed off.
Very pissed off.
Give me your prediction, Super Bowl.
It's going to go one of two ways. Either it's going to be high scoring and it's going to be high scoring and the Panthers blow them out. Or if the Broncos offense can do what the Giants did to Buffalo back in 1990, the Broncos have a puncher's chance. Peyton is not going to be able to outscore Cam Newton. He's not going to be able to, he just doesn't have the arm strength anymore to throw like five touchdowns in the second half. It's not going to happen.
We had a hedge. Glenn Butler had a new Wednesday walk on the web. Check that out. Neil Chama back as the Walt Disney World traveler looking at the Resort 2016 preview. A lot of changes coming to all of the resorts there at Disney, so be sure to check that out. Neil catches you up on when the best time to go over the next few years maybe. Talks about the new attractions opening, others closing. So if you're a Disney fan or planning a trip, that is a must-read. Brian Bayless had your Raw report. Will and I were back, first time in a month, with a Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast. We played some cool games. We did a little Living the Gimmick with Kevin Nash. We ranked our favorite Rumble undercard matches, and then we built an Ultimate Royal Rumble, so be sure to check that out. Also, a brand new Between the Sheets, looking at January 26th to February 1st of 1991 with Chris and Bix. Chad Campbell continues his look at IWA, Mid-South, the last great territory, new installments of all your other favorite podcasts as well along the lines. Scott Keith had a Place to Be exclusive mailbag, written form, check that out. And if you haven't read yet, Parv's piece on Why Roman Reigns Isn't Over, a study in parallels at Roman Reigns, Bob Backlund, Dory Funk Jr. Incredibly well-researched, a very in-depth look at why he believes Reigns is not over. It got a lot of praise, that piece. It was really well done, long form, a lot of results mixed in, a lot of analysis. So be sure to check that out. Highly recommended piece about Roman Reigns. And also quickly, we'll plug the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular. Episode 5, Talks in Politics, looking at the Iowa caucus. Episode 6, Reopening the X-Files. Of course, the return of the X-Files as Glenn and Scott, the brothers of discussion, brought in Andy Helene to talk about X-Files. And Andy also gave an X-Files primer written piece, so be sure to seek that out as well. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation. Twitter, Place Number 2 Be Nation. Tumblr, Instagram, it's all there for you. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Indeed. Let's go back to Houston, the planet Houston. And two matches left, JR. Good show so far. Okay.
Yeah, there's been some surprisingly good stuff. I think the four-way was really good. I think JBL Mysterio was pretty good. So up and down.
Okay.
Nothing right home, but nothing. I wouldn't call it like trash or anything.
Right. No, I wouldn't either. And again, two matches left, both title matches. Next up, the Cruiserweight Championship on the line, your champion, Nunzio, taking on a guy who was a former WCW Cruiserweight champion and part of an awesome heel. I don't know what they are now. They're more like a tweener stable.
Yeah.
But we have not talked about the Cruiserweight title since the last pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. So we had a big title change.
Yeah, Nunzio defeated Paul London to win that title on August 6th, Velocity, thanks to an assist from Vito making his WWE debut. We'll talk about him in a moment. Mm-hmm. On 10-8, Juventud won a Battle Royal to earn this title match. Nunzio had his problems with the Mexicools prior to the match when Psychosis and Super Crazy defeated him in non-title singles and tag matches leading up to the show. Vito Legrasso began his wrestling career in 1990, did a bunch of WWF job duty in the early 90s, and then went to ECW as Skull Von Crush, who later changed his name to Vito the Skull Legrasso, started up a stable known as the Baldies, would remain in ECW until 1999, went to WCW, joined up with Johnny Stamboli to become the Mama Lukes. They would win the tag team titles, remain a unit until WCW closed. Vito got lost in the buyout shuffle and would eventually reshuffle over to TNA. After a brief stint there, he would sign a developmental deal in early 05. God, they were handing those things out to everyone in early 05.
Yeah, no, Jesus.
After some time in OVW, debuted on the 8-6 Velocity and basically restarting the Mama Luke Mafia kind of gimmick that they had in WCW with him and now Nunzio, of course, who was longtime Little Guido in ECW. Yep. And of course, Vito used to wrestle under Von Cruz, was his big job name. Showed up a lot on Superstars and Raw
yes.
in those early
yep.
episodes.
Yep.
So interesting match here. And Hoovy, you know, he was a good choice, I think, of... Super Crazy is really good, too. So is Psychosis. I mean, all three Mexicals are really good, but Hoovy's definitely been, you know, set up as the leader of the group in many ways.
Yeah, he was.
And a real tough spot for this match. Basically, after the murder and the casket, they have to roll these guys out here for this Cruiserweight match. And they're great wrestlers, but, you know, the story and the general history of these types of matches don't have great crowd reactions for WWE. So to drag them out there after a moment like that was in a real tough spot. I was surprised that the Mexicals lasted this long, especially when the BWO crumbled. I'm glad they did, but it seems very un-WWE-like that they'd make it this far. Not much of a reaction, but at least they have a gimmick and a distinct look, and same goes for Nunzio and Vito. I thought Nunzio's been a good champion since he won it and sets up for a pretty good match here. Hoovy keeps the pressure on early, goes for covers whenever he can. We get a series of reversals with Hoovy keeping the advantage, getting near fall off a backbreaker. Hoovy heads up top, but Nunzio yanks him hard to the mat, and it goes to work on the back. Both end up battling on the top rope and take each other off of the face buster. Hoovy gets a kick and a near fall, but the crowd is just completely dead here. Hoovy gets a nice low drop kick for two, hits an inverted sit-out powerbomb. Vito ties up Hoovy, but it doesn't work and gets taken down with a head scissors. Hoovy hits a crossbody, but Nunzio rolls through for two. Hoovy fights for a Nunzio attack and hits a driver for the win as the Mexicals block Vito. And again, despite the completely flat crowd, I thought this was pretty good. I thought they worked hard. And a nice win by Hoovy. I think it was a good choice to give him the belt. They worked well. It was fun. The celebration was fun after. It was a cool moment. You know, not the best Cruiserweight match in history, but, you know, better than what we've probably had over the last year or so throughout the Spike stuff and everything else. So, really, since the heyday of the division, one of the better matches, I think. And I think Hoovy is a very good choice for champion.
I agree. It was a really good match. I enjoyed it. I like Hoovy. I think the highlight for me was afterwards when Carlos and Hugo actually got,
you know,
like post-match interviews. And
they made a big deal about it, which I was glad
to see. Yeah,
it
was definitely
a
big deal. Yeah.
And it's funny. Like, did you think the Mexicals will last this long, let alone win titles?
No, because they're certainly not. We were talking about Bobby Lashley. Was it Vince guy? Well, these guys certainly not Vince guys, they were funny with their wand ears and... And what's his name? Psychosis had a great line. He goes, "You're the grass, and we're gonna mow you." Or he said something really stupid. It was really funny when he was doing the post match interview. But it was a good match. Fast paced. Hoovy's a little more over than Nunzio. I felt like Nunzio was more of a holdover guy. And on a funny note, I think it's the most velocity references we've had in a single match in the history of the Vintage Vaults. On this velocity, then on this velocity, then on this velocity.
Know, right?
What the hell do we ever do that? But awesome. Good match. And Juventud is your new WWE Cruiserweight Champion. And it was a good little match for just under 7 minutes.
Yeah, fine.
I enjoyed it.
Fine stuff. All right.
All right.
We go backstage again.
Yep.
Simon Dean eats an entire tray of hamburgers now, finishes it off. But Lashley says that was only 19 and he has one more to go. Before he can eat the 20th, Dean runs away and throws up as Lashley just sits there laughing. And I thought these were pretty effective to get Lashley over. Like, he didn't have to talk a lot. He looked menacing. He kind of was being a rapscallion. Simon Dean, had this coming to him after being such an asshole. And I thought it made Lashley seem very likable and just a kind of a quiet, tough guy that you don't want to mess with.
Right, exactly. No, it was good. It was a good start for Lashley. And we'll see more of him over the next few months, kind of building slowly And then by like the middle of 06, he really, comes into his own on SmackDown. So,
and it was a fun running story because they were quick. They were quick hits and they didn't drag on,
Yeah. No, exactly. They threw it in there every couple matches, funny gig, and the burgers were all mushed together and worked out good. Mm-hmm. It was a fun little filler for this pay-per-view, kind of stretch it out a little bit. So it was good. All right. Main event time. Are you ready? We knew the day would come where we'd have to do this, but... Your World Heavyweight Championship on the line, your champion, Batista, a new number one contender. Do you want to do the official fun fact at the end, and we'll just do the match part now?
Yeah, so we've got the match. And then we'll
talk about that. How do we get to this point, then?
So following SummerSlam, Eddie Guerrero finally defeated Rey Mysterio in that cage match we talked about earlier on the September 9th SmackDown. Soon after, he was named number one contender to the World Heavyweight title. Eddie would claim to be Batista's best friend, a role Batista played along with, figuring he could keep an eye on the tricky Guerrero. Batista continued to play mind games, and Eddie would occasionally turn back to his cheating ways during matches when Batista and Eddie were facing Eminem. Guerrero and Batista would defeat JBL and Christian in a tag match, with Guerrero reaffirming his friendship with the champion. After the show, the two men would begin to show mutual respect, and Eddie poured his soul to Batista about his struggles and basically turned face. Rumors, of course, that Eddie's abounded, that Eddie's face turn would be temporary, and he would soon go heel again and defeat Batista for the title at a future date. So that's pretty much what set us up. And the feud was really fun. Everyone waiting for Eddie to go heel and cheat, but he kept staying clean, be friends with Batista, Batista playing along. And I thought it made Batista seem even cooler and smart because he knows the jig, but he's just playing along. And it's similar to kind of what he did with Triple H.
Yep. Yep.
And I thought it was his first, you know, good feud since Triple H. He's had, you know, the JBL stuff that's kind of stunk up the, you know, main events a little bit. But to me, he was finally able to dig his teeth in a little bit here. And Eddie has a really cool new theme song. Big Eddie chants, a big pop. Batista has a great championship star look and kind of tough to watch when Eddie comes out, just knowing, you know, in hindsight. Story is whether the sneaky, savvy veteran Eddie will expose Batista and steal the title, or will Batista be able to stay on to his tricks. Eddie takes down Batista early, looking to ground him, and they start feeling each other out, working a friendly offense to start things off. Batista slams Eddie off the top and then smiles and smirks as he controls the action. And Eddie's trying to figure things out. Eddie lands a shot on the arm, and Batista gives him a knowing look and laugh. Feeling out continues. Batista uses a headlock and powers to negate Eddie's speed. Eddie grabs a chair, but Batista yanks it away and then scolds him. Kind of grabs him by the face and yells at him. Drags him into the ring. Eddie snaps Batista's neck across the rope and then sprints to the top and hits a frog splash to the back, but only gets a two count. I love that sequence, too, where Eddie's been biding his time, kind of playing a coy. Catches Batista and then boom, up to the top, bang, hits a frog splash, but can only get two. Like, I love that. It was almost like he was setting him up the whole time, right?
Yes. Oh, I agree. That was great when they were messing around on the ropes. I agree 100%. I caught that. When that hit me, I'm like, wow, that was a good sequence.
Yes,
I agree.
Well worked. Eddie hooked a body scissors and lands some strikes to the lower back before going to a single crab. And I liked the flow here. It's really interesting because you could kind of feel both guys looking for a hole and trying to figure out a way to pick each other apart within the rules, because Eddie doesn't want to cheat. He's trying to keep up the guys. Batista's hanging with him. And it was kind of fun that way, that you could kind of see the mental game going on with the two of them, trying to find which would be the best method to put the other one down. Batista reverses a cloverleaf into an inside cradle for two, and Cole wonders if Batista's starting to get desperate because he's getting away from his game. Taz kind of shoots that down. Ref gets bumped accidentally when Eddie loses his balance. Eddie realizes the situation, smiles, and grabs a chair, but then hesitates and chucks it to the floor, looking kind of sad. Batista calls out Eddie for even thinking about it and slams him into the corner, rattles him with a big clothesline. Eddie reverses a Batista bomb, but Batista hits a spinebuster, and then the lower back injuries to Batista prevent him from covering. Eddie recovers first and hits three amigos, but comes up empty on a frog splash. Batista hits a spinebuster right after that for the win. Hard-fought victory. I thought it was really smartly booked within the storyline. They get a clean handshake. Eddie stayed true to his word, but it cost him in the end. I thought the selling by Batista was really good. Batista's reign is going well. Feuds like this only continue to help him develop. A really strong main event to close out the show. I thought it was not like this phenomenal work rate match, but I thought it was really smart. I thought they played within the storyline so well with all the sneaky Eddie stuff and Batista having one eye on him at all times, and then, you know, Eddie with the trying to get the flash wins, and then Batista just getting the victory. And honestly, I was surprised when Batista pinned him, because I always thought this was a DQ. So it actually caught me off guard when he pinned him, because in my mind, I always thought it ended in a schmoz, maybe because it seems like that's always the format for these shows, but Eddie taking the clean loss. And I think this gets Batista firmly back on track. And in our monthly kind of tracker, you know, I think Batista still looks better. And I think, you know, we talked about month by month kind of talking who should have been on what show. I think as we look here, Batista would have been my A-plus guy on Raw. Cena would have still been working SmackDown at this time. I thought Batista has more of the star power and presence than Cena does right now.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Now, and having said that, I think Cena Eddie would have been a great feud if you wanted to swap the two spots, and then you wanted to have, if you were going to do the title here, I think the two of them in a feud would be fantastic. But there's no doubt Batista just gets it. Yeah. I'm not saying Cena doesn't, but we'll get more into that on next week's Vault. on our next vault. Batista just gets it. Mm-hmm. And he just has that natural kind of suave. And we've said this over and over again, but once again, it shows here as well. He just looks good as champion.
Nothing seems forced with Batista.
Exactly.
Cena seems to have to kind of fight to be cool. Batista just is cool. That's the difference.
Yep. Great way to put it. Now, as for the match, I think the storytelling was fantastic. It kind of harkens to, except in reverse roles in terms of who the champion and challenger was, obvious example reminds you of Piper and Brett at WrestleMania 8, mm-hmm. where Piper was fighting to go back to old school Piper with the chair and everything. And I mean, he only had one instance in that match, but here, Eddie, two or three times, picking chairs up, dropping chairs.
And the difference here, the story is, too, that he had the promise to Batista that he'd keep it clean.
Right.
And so now he's fighting on himself because he's such a natural cheater, but he has this promise to Batista and has fought so hard to get his image back in place after the Dominic stuff that he doesn't want to blow it. But on the flip side, is he still baiting him here, knowing what he has in his back pocket down the line?
Yeah, and they had to have at least one moment. Like, just doing it during the match is one thing, but the one that when the ref got bumped, when Nick Patrick hit the ground, and Eddie had the chair in his hand, that was if you really wanted to put that aspect of the story over, you really needed to have a moment where Eddie could have won. Because Batista was half out of it, ref's not looking, Eddie hits him with a chair, pins him, he could be world heavyweight champion. So you had to have at least one of those moments where it going to the old Eddie would have gotten you the world heavyweight championship. And that was the case there. Mm-hmm. So it was just great storytelling. Yeah, the match isn't five stars or anything, but that's okay. You know, they don't all have to be. As long as you're entertained and the psychology works and tells a great story. Batista definitely in-ring rebounds because I think mm-hmm. he worked well with Eddie.
Yeah, very.
To get away from the lumbering shit show that was the two matches with JBL.
Right.
This was 10 times better.
And he just feels like a top guy. He looks like a top guy. He carries himself like a top guy.
Yeah.
He acts like a top guy. Wrestles like a top guy. He feels like a believable world champion. And it's been a boon to SmackDown to have a guy, we talked about JBL's reign and how there were parts to enjoy, but this has been big for SmackDown to have this credible, mm-hmm. believable ace top gun on top of the brand. Yep. And it's sad. It's sad to see Eddie in such a great high-level feud back in the main events after he kind of, cracked in 04 now that feel like maybe he's back to the point where he can revisit the idea and starting to feel good, kind of getting there, and then obviously, things take a turn. This is Eddie Guerrero's final pay-per-view match. As November dawned, there were rumors that Vince McMahon was going to put the title back on Eddie's waist, feeling he was better prepared mentally to carry the brand than he was back in early 04. Eddie would wrestle Ken Kennedy on the 11-11 SmackDown, earning a slot on the SmackDown team for Survivor Series, but unfortunately and very tragically never made it that far. On the morning of November 13th, Chavo Guerrero went to Eddie's hotel room, but when he entered, Eddie was unconscious on the floor. Chavo attempted CPR, but when the paramedics arrived, they declared Eddie Guerrero had passed away. The autopsy later revealed that Eddie had passed from heart failure. It was clear that his hard partying past and steroid abuse had led to his demise. That week's WWE programming was fully dedicated to Eddie's memory, but his passing would lead to a more of a legacy than he probably ever imagined, because upon his death, WWE and Vince McMahon came under heavy public fire due to their lax drug and steroid testing policies. And this all came at a time when Congress was heavily pressing football and baseball for their drug testing as well. Eddie's death, along with the public pressure, forced WWE into creating a wellness policy, which included drug violation policies, mandatory medical testing to ensure wrestlers weren't competing in a dangerous physical state, because it was clear that Eddie had been in a very, very bad state prior to his death, and that would be later confirmed by his wife. For better or worse, part of his legacy as a wrestler and as a legend is this wellness policy. And, Scott, we've been talking a lot throughout 05 how all these guys were gassed and juiced out of their mind. It was HGH mm-hmm. heaven for these, just out of control throughout 05. And we see a lot of deflation over the next couple months. And it's not permanent yet because it kind of gets forgotten again until something else happens. But at the time, all of a sudden, everyone starts to shrink a bit. And guys start getting banged on violations. And all of a sudden they have something new to contend with, not just injury and switching promotions. Now they got to worry about guys, failing drug tests again, like they did in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. you know, very storied, epic career, legacy, one of the most talented wrestlers, charisma, could have epic work rate matches, found his groove really when he returned in 2002 as a maybe, you know, where he became the most well-rounded he had ever been, you know, from a storytelling point of view and from an in-ring point of view. Cautionary as well. Like so many other guys behind, you know, before him, he lived and partied hard, had the car accident back in 99, and then got on the juice, was, you know, way bigger than he ever should have been on the frame that he had. And you could see that throughout his time in WWE since he came back. And even here in 05, you could tell he was starting to break down, you know, limping a bit more, walking gingerly, almost a lot of comparisons to Brian Pillman's final days in many ways, you know, just the way he was walking and carrying himself and just still overly gassed. And we talked about the back knee and the way, you know, everything else that was going on with him. You know, you'd hope that he learned not to follow Art Barr, who was his friend and late tag team partner, who had passed away from many of the same issues, and Eddie ended up paying for it with his life. Final record, 20-25, 1-2 at the Rumble, 2-3 at Mania, 0-2 at King of the Ring, 2-3 at SummerSlam, 3-1 at Survivor Series, 12-14 other shows. And, you know, Eddie was one of my favorites. He was a great competitor, obviously one of the greatest of all time when you put the whole package together. And this one shook me up bad. I was just turning 25, kind of had a bit of a quarter-life crisis around that time. And Eddie passing, you know, you start to almost, you know, your 20s, you feel immortal. As you hit the midway point, you start to maybe realize you're not. And having a guy like this that you really follow closely and had grown up with in many ways, die of a heart attack, shakes you up pretty bad. And I remember, like, not being able to sleep for nights, like, just, you know, freaked out by what had happened. And it took me a while to kind of feel okay with it. And, you know, the Eddie tribute shows were really well done. And it was tough. It was a tough one. I think probably the hardest I took a wrestling death since Pillman, I'd say, was Eddie. So it really messed me up.
Oh, I remember that day. In fact, I was talking to the doctor about it earlier because
I was with you, right? And then I went home and found out.
Yeah, I'm trying to, and I was even trying to figure out what the hell we were doing. I mean, I don't know if you were here or we were up there. I don't know. And I remember we were in the doctor's basement. And we were
no, I was
cleaning.
There because I drove home and put on the computer and saw that he died, and then I called you, and I'm like,
"Yeah, you
shit.
Called, yeah, you called his, you called doctor's house phone, and I mean this when you talk about the three deaths, it's like almost the trinity of pain, if you will, Pillman, Owen, and Eddie. Owens was just sucked because it was, you know, you could say it was avoidable or whatever, but that just came out
avoidable.
Of left field.
It was 100%
you know?
Avoidable.
Yeah, that was
he,
avoidable.
He did nothing to himself like Pillman. No. I mean, Pillman and Eddie are sad, but they brought every ounce of it on themselves.
Exactly. And it breaks your heart because there was no – you would have thought by 2005 that these – that smaller guys – I mean – and it's this goes for, you know, some of his other cohorts over the next, you know, year and a half. You would have figured by this point that the guys that were 250 pounds, 240 pounds, 230 pounds, we were past that Vince, that stage where Vince only liked guys that looked like fucking Bobby Lashley or Hercules or, you know, friggin' jacked up huge dudes. That we had passed that because we had Sean. And Sean was the poster boy for being able to be 220 pounds, 225 pounds, and still be a main eventer, and still set the world on fire, and still put on great main event matches, and still carry promotions. And it kills you that all the shit Eddie did in the 2000, I mean, he was a mess at the end of 2000, going into 01, if you remember, and he got pulled over, he got in a car accident or whatever, and I mean, he spent most, pretty much all of 2001 bouncing around and trying to do something to clear his life up. And when he came back in 02, he was on fire. And, and we talked about maybe some of the greatest feuds. He had two awesome feuds in 2002. He had the great feud with RVD for the IC belt, that great ladder match on Raw when the guy ran into the ring. And then remember the Trinity matches he had with Edge at the tail end of the summer.
And the SmackDown
were really, really good.
Stuff too.
And the SmackDown 6 stuff. But by 03... is when you started to see Eddie start to get a little, you know, mangled looking. Maybe by the end of 03 into 04. And It just, why, Eddie? You didn't need to.
That's
Vince. Vince was past that stage now, but I mean,
not really. I mean, I think the pressure was still there within WWE to be bigger. I mean, I don't know. I think it
sucks.
I think it's a little blind to sit here and say Vince was past it because of Shawn Michaels 10 years before. You know, I think at this point it was starting to infiltrate itself again. I think the rise of HGH is what really did it. You know what I mean? Like, I think, sure, steroids or, you know, the hardcore stuff had really been phased out and still used, obviously. But I think the growth of HGH in all sports really led to it. I mean, you know, you could say, oh, Vince was saying to whatever, he didn't care. But if you look at the whole culture of sports at that time, it's HGH madness, like baseball, you know, 2000
absolutely.
To 2006, 7, 8, 9. I mean, that's when it was at its peak.
Yep.
You know, I'm sure, you know, football too. You heard about basketball too. These guys having to play, you know, three nights in a row or whatever, back to backs. And, you know, it's prevalent in all sports. And wrestling was no different. And, of course, the Sports Illustrated article 2 years later did the series on steroid and HGH ring that was run by that, you know, pharmacy. And Eddie Guerrero was on the list of someone who had received HGH and steroids in 2005. So at a time where, you know, thought maybe he was clean, I think he was from a drug and alcohol point of view and a pill point of view, but he was clearly still, you know, juicing big time. Mm-hmm. And that played a role, obviously, in his death, because when you're weak, you know, you already have a weak heart due to drug use and everything else. To pack on that much muscle to your frame that, you know, it's not built to carry, and your heart starts having to pump extra and try and support this extra muscle, is just eventually just going to give out. And, you know, gave out at a time where he was just finding his way back to the main events and getting himself in order. And it was tough. It was tough to take. And all the other promotions out there did stuff for him. TNA dedicated their pay-per-view to him. Ring of Honor did the same. OVW, Combat Zone Wrestling, like many other promotions. Because Guerrero is, well, you know, beloved. He'd been around forever, had made stops everywhere. And he was a guy that many respected. So, you know, at the end of the day, you didn't hear much bad about Eddie Guerrero, especially once he cleaned himself up. And, you know, kind of refound himself. But, it was obviously very sad. It was tough. And, I think, was it the first major death since Owen for them? And there have been other ones, like, you know,
well,
Hawk,
I mean, there was,
and Mr.
I mean,
Perfect
there were,
and Bulldog. But I
yeah,
feel like
Hawk.
We haven't had, like, an active guy since Owen.
No. Not since, definitely not since, since Owen. So, with that high profile, yeah.
Right, but I'd say this is probably the biggest since then. I mean, you know, again, a lot of bigger names have passed away, but none active and none in the main event. I mean, you could even argue Owen wasn't even the main event, and, you know, just due to the scope of it, even, you know, Pillman wasn't the main event. This is the first guy that was legitimately in the middle of a world title feud to just drop dead. And, you know, many ways they lucked out that they didn't put the belt on him at No Mercy and that they were going to wait. But, I mean, there were rumors that he was set to win it as close as that week. That I don't know how legitimate those are, but... it sounded like at the very least by Survivor Series, there was a chance he was going to be champion.
Right.
But who knows? Again, who knows how much is that is real or not, but, yeah, sad day, sad time to be a fan. I know it took me a few weeks to get back into things, after that. And of course they did the, you know, the Johnny Cash doing the cover of the Nine Inch Nails Hurt song, which was like, you know, the theme for this whole thing, and just like gut wrenching to watch the video package with that song playing, and real tough stuff.
I would argue that Raw the next night, might be the toughest 2 hours I ever watched, 2 hours of wrestling I ever watched in my life.
You think worse than the Owen Raw's?
I think Owen, because it was a tragic accident, but the stories they were telling, it just seemed like I don't know. There was something different about that Raw. This Raw just was a, like you said, it was a stomach punch, because once you found out why, you were like, oh, why, Eddie? You knew you didn't have to, you know. And just watching all the guys up there, and Chavo, who took it himself. We talked about it at Unforgiven? Yeah, Unforgiven. He was freaking mangled to the gills. He was misshapen. It sucks because, unfortunately, you could do a lot of lip service about stuff like that, but it takes a somebody has to be made an example of, whether it's, you know, fate or whatever, to wake you up. And we've spent all of 2005 talking about these guys, the Kurtz and the Chavos and, you know, Masters and all these other guys that are just, you could just tell they're just flying out of their skin. But a guy who probably universally loved by everybody, you know, every fan around the world, from those battles with Dean in ECW and WCW to obviously, you know, pretty much an 8-year feud with Ray in a roundabout way. You know, the matches that we talked about earlier with the fun stuff with China when he, you know, took him to the prom and he was trying to get to, into the Playboy Mansion, just anything. He was a funny guy. Mm-hmm. He had a great charisma. And whether he was the funny kind of smart ass baby face or that just smarmy scumbag heel, he knew how to do it. He knew how to do both, great.
And he was clearly the complete package. I mean, you know, yep. Like you said, he was funny, had the charisma, could connect, he could work. And I think that's where, you know, the comparison's always with him and a Benoit and a Malenko and those guys. Like, to me, Eddie was always the most complete package because he could work in the ring, he could be a great face, he could be a great heel, mm-hmm. he could, you know, get it done in any kind of style of match. He's had, you know, great matches that are strictly work rate. He's had great story matches like this one, and some really memorable moments. And he had a really great WWE career. And that was on top of an already great WCW career, which is piled on top of a really good Mexico career. So, it, you know, a lot there on Eddie's resume, a lot of great line items. And, yeah, I mean, it was a tough blow for the company in many ways because he was so prominently featured and so beloved. And then the legacy, of course, like we mentioned with the drug testing and everything else. Yeah. So.
And the difference, the other big difference between Eddie's death and Owens and Pillman's. Pillman was sadly like a back end, you know, mid card guy who just happened to die.
Right.
Which sucked bad. And I know many like you were shaken by that. For the company, Owen, I mean, they took a lot of shit for a couple months and then it just kind of, you know, faded.
Oh shit! I mean, they basically killed them.
Yeah, and they took a lot of crap, and they with every, you know, and not just that, but whether Vince should have stopped the show and all that kind of. We won't get into that. We got into that already. This is one where, unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately, depending on your point of view, a silver lining had to, you know, came from this, which is like, all right, we got to look in the mirror. We got guys all over. I mean, this is Eddie.
But even then, I don't think it was there. I don't think this got him there. It was the public pressure and everything else going on. Like, I don't think Vince said, oh, Eddie died. Oh, my God, look.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, of course not. Like, no, of course not. No,
this didn't make
that.
Him realize people were on HGH.
No. I know that. I'm saying that eventually, if there was going to be a silver lining, this on top of, you know, again, the pressure of Jesus. Look at your roster. They're friggin' mangled looking. They're all misshapen and shit had to happen. So like you said, if Eddie's legacy was we now have a wellness policy, whether people can make fun of it or not, that it's half-assed or whatever, that's their problem. But the fact that it did happen and guys did get punished for it, and we're going to have a pay-per-view in a couple years where maybe it's in a year where we have, like, you know, I think they call it the liver enzyme pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. But sadly, if Eddie's legacy is that it smartened up the business and smartened up sports to really look in the mirror and realize – that we're getting, you know, we're in deep shit here.
Well, what didn't help too with this whole thing was he, you know, so much of the redemption story that had just been told, like that made it tough too. Like the book, the DVD, winning mm-hmm. the title, the stuff with Brock Lesnar, like that was so fresh in our minds. Like he had seemed like he had overcome so much and finally made it. And then this happens. Like to me, that's what made this so hard as well. You know, like, we had just learned his whole story, and he had just got himself fixed up and cleaned up and just everything that had come out about it. And then all of a sudden it's like this, you know, and to me that's what made it worse as well.
Yeah. If you don't have the cheating, death, stealing life, I don't have that one. But if you have the Viva La Raza, which came out, I think the following year, maybe the year after that, it's a great 3-disc set. What if you have do you have 3 matches or 4 matches that stick out for you as perfect examples of how great he was?
Well, obviously Ray at Halloween Havoc.
Yep.
Halloween Havoc. The pure work rate.
Yep.
The Brock match from work rate and storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
The matches with Angle, you know,
yeah,
great.
Yep.
like you said, the Edge series, how he worked hard to get Edge, bring Edge up a level. The match they had on SmackDown was the best of the bunch. SmackDown 6 stands out. And probably the RVD stuff. I mean, you know, the way he came back and they put him over so strong, just let him completely decimate RVD in that feud early on. Was great, too. And, I mean, I'm missing a lot of WCW stuff, but he had some great matches just on and off there. But the Ray ones always stand out.
For me, it's the definitely Havoc 97. I mean, that match is practically flawless. And I remember their, I think their World War II match the next month was pretty good, too, if I remember correctly.
World War III. I
mean, World War III. Yes. The World War III one. I meant second match, World War III. That last match, the farewell match that him and Dean had in ECW.
Yeah.
In what was it, like August or September 95? That match is fucking incredible. The SmackDown one with Edge, that Raw ladder match with RVD was fucking great. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. And then just for his career, regardless of what happened after the fact, beating Brock at No Way Out 04 and being the top guy is a moment you'll never, when he's hugging his mom and, you know, it's funny that it worked for him because they did it in a city that had a very, you know, San Francisco had a heavy Latino fan base, and it was a big moment for him. So there is no doubt that, I mean, wrestling death in general is sad, obviously, and wrestling deaths are sad. This one, I agree with you. This one really hit you hard because, I mean, you're talking about your 20s. I was in my early 30s, and you're not mortal. These guys are that they're supposed to be these warriors, and but they're human beings like the rest of us. And whether it's their own fault or fate, things like this happen. You know,
it came so out of nowhere too. Like that was a big part of it as well. Like I mean, really, it's the last thing you were thinking about. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, even though I guess you found out later he wasn't feeling well, or when you kind of look back, you see it. But when you're in the moment, you just kind of either don't notice it, or you're kind of blissfully ignoring it. You know what I mean? One or the other. So on some level, you're just not noticing what's going on. So when that happened, you're like, oh my God, just it completely out of left field. You just, the last thing you expected to happen.
Right.
It's tough. It's tough to see a guy who was active go down like that, but.
And one moment quickly before we go, one moment on that Raw, or did they do it on the SmackDown? Cause they did both shows. Yeah. I think it was probably the SmackDown because it was Batista. Or was Batista on Raw, too? He probably came over and was on Raw, too.
I don't think they separated it. I mean, there were no storylines. And they also said, like, guys didn't have to wrestle if they didn't want to. It was kind of an open thing.
Was that the night they did Ray and Shawn?
Yes.
Yeah. But there is a moment. You know, we were just talking about cool collective Batista, Guy carries himself great and everything. And he gets in the ring and they have the low rider. Vince drive up in the low rider or whatever. They have the big pop or who's your poppy t-shirt on the hood. And Batista's just a blubbering mess.
Yeah.
And this is Batista who's, he's cool. He's slick. He's Batista. And he was just a fucking disaster in the ring. And then he lays the world heavyweight title on the, It sucked. I mean, it was touching and it was nice, but just the general, it sucked that we actually had this had to happen. That Raw is just, I think I have both on tape. I think I taped them. It sucked. It sucked to watch. It was just devastating. And just seeing Chavo and Benoit, they put the camera on those guys, not just everybody, those guys, the guys that were closest to him. They put the camera on when they did the Toll the Bell. And they showed Chavo and Benoit and Ray. Ray was a disaster, crying through his mask. It's probably one of the most memorable and saddest Raws in the history of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can get – Owens was
– there were just two different kinds of shows. I don't think you need to compare. It's fine.
Yeah, I don't think it matters. But those 2 hours are just – they rip your heart out. They really do. If you have it – honestly, if you have it nearby and you want to, I don't want to say get depressed, but if you want to just feel a special moment, I'd put it on. And I remember the SmackDown that week being pretty good too. But it ripped your heart out. It definitely did. Now, having said that, the show, take that part away from it. this match, I think, saves the show from being kind of a mess. Right? Overall, I mean, this match was very good.
Yeah, the match was really good. And no, I think the show closed strongly enough. Like, I thought Ray JBL was really good. Taker stuff was fine. The Cruiserweight match was fine. I mean, you know, I think it's a perfectly average pay-per-view with some good, and I don't think anything's really bad. Like, I think it just it goes from like kind of blah to pretty good. So, you know, it's in that C range. But there's this stuff here to like. It's not a waste. It's not a throwaway. And I think it continues the trend that the 05 shows have been much more serviceable and better lasting than some of those 04 shows that were downright bad. Like, I don't think we've had really a bad one here in 05. There's at least been something redeeming in every episode, in every pay-per-view. And I think this main event was really good. It's kind of a hidden gem. And I think it gets forgotten because we never get the story. We never get the culmination of the storyline in this feud. So we don't really know where it would have ended. So it almost kind of gets overlooked, and I think people maybe purposely overlook it because they want to, you know, maybe forget what happened and not remember what happened. But the match itself was pretty good. So that'll do it for No Mercy 05. And, you know, if you have thoughts on Eddie Guerrero that you want to share, this gets posted up on Facebook and Twitter. Just share them with us, you know, where you were when you found out, and your memories of them, your favorite Eddie matches. You know, share those thoughts with us. Share your memories of Eddie with us. We'll love to read them and hear them. So, Scott, we'll be back in a couple weeks. We'll be back here with Taboo Tuesday 05, It's going to be a very special night. We're not going to get too much into it here, but we'll talk about it when that arrives.
Yes.
Special for many reasons. So, with that said, we'll go ahead and wrap up for tonight. So, for Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Taboo Tuesday. Get ready to vote. Rest in peace.
What I want, I can tell you a yes man, putting with the gangster lean. It's about that time, oh boy. I keep the sky high, he la rola high, bien machine. That's how I do it, 102-12. Now it's time to get this party cracking. It's time to let them know what's happening. It's about time I step in with the gangster lean. No talking, I get what I want. I can tell you a yes man, putting with the gangster lean. It's about that time. I keep the sky high, he la rola high, bien machine. That's how I do it, 102-12. Now it's time to get this party cracking. It's time to let them know what's happening. It's about time I step in with the gangster lean. No talking, I get what I want. I can tell you a yes man, put in with the gangster lean. It's about that time, oh boy. I keep the sky high, he la rola high, bien machine. That's how I do it, 102-12. Now it's time to get this party cracking. It's time to let them know what's happening. It's about time I stepped in.